The committee will come to order. Representative Bunn, will you move the March 10th minutes?
Thank you, Chair Thiessen. I move the March 10th minutes.
All right, any discussion? We do have a roll call in here, so if people want to make sure they're all right on that, that'd be one thing. Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The minutes are adopted. Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is an amendment to the bill, too.
Okay, I will move House File 388 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Justice.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
And I'll also move the A2 amendment, which looks fairly technical. Any discussion on the A2 amendment? Seeing that, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. All right, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually am going to let the background of the information be told by the testifiers and my constituents today, but to the bill, as amended, it restricts the clinical drug... Here, I'll... House File 388 does as amended is, after a hearing and before a commitment order has been issued on a stayed civil commitment, we are asking that the patient be prohibited from participating in a psychiatric clinical drug trial while the order is in effect. And we also deleted lines 1.23 and lines 1.24, which were for consistency sake, which is more of a technical issue. With that, I will turn the testimony over to Mary Reese and Mike Howard.
Thank you, Carla. First of all, I want to thank Carla. Can you all hear me?
Yeah, and if you could just state your name for the record.
My name is Mary Weiss, W-E-I-S-S.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Carla for all her very, very hard work on this important bill. And for Mindy Greiling for co-authoring it, for everybody who has supported it. And hopefully after we finish here today, you will all understand why this is so very important. My son, Dan Markinson, died almost 5 years ago. And, you know, it doesn't seem like 5 years, it doesn't seem like a year, but almost 5 years ago, while he was in a clinical study. I don't plan to mention any doctor's names or any hospital names. That's not relevant here. My son was the most amazing person I've ever known, and, you know, probably most mothers think that. He was very intelligent. He graduated from the University of Michigan after finishing 2 years at Hamline with a perfect 4.0 and went to California to sell a screenplay he had completed. And I was all for that. I wanted him to spread his wings and become part of the world. And unfortunately, in the summer of 2003, I went out there and I discovered, which would be a horror to any parent, that Dan had become mentally ill and that I had to get him home to Minnesota to be treated. And I had no doubt but that I would be able to get him home, he would be treated, he would return to California, and maybe even now I'd be a grandmother, but that isn't how it happened. Dan did not get into Regions because they had no room. He was accepted at another hospital, and 2 days later, his attending physician, who was also the principal investigator in a study at that hospital, completed a form, which was actually a court form, called the Examiner's Statement in Support of Petition for Commitment. I thought that this was probably the best way to get Dan treated. It was very naive. I knew nothing. The doctor on the form filled out a check that Dan was in need of neuroleptic medication but that he did not believe he has a mental illness. And I have handouts on these for all of you. And according to the website of the Ombudsman's Office, it indicates, and this should have stopped everything right there, it indicates in determining capacity to give consent to enter a clinical study that the person has to have an understanding of what's wrong with him or her and has to believe that she or he has a mental illness. This did not stand from going into the study. He was committed, and that commitment was stayed by court order. And the court order mandated Dan to get treatment. They did not suggest he get treatment or say it would be kind of nice if you got treatment. They said you must get treatment. That was one of the conditions for the stay being, for the commitment being stayed. Otherwise, he would have gone to Anoka State Hospital, which, of course, I wish he had. He would be alive now. But he signed into a study called CAFE, Comparison of Atypicals for First Episodes. Even though he had no diagnosis to fit the study. And I would make Dan's entire hospital file available to anyone who would like to read it. Dan had no diagnosis all the time he was in the hospital from November 12th of 2003 until December 8th of 2003, other than psychosis, NOS. NOS means not otherwise specified. Dan signed a consent form to go into the hospital, and we knew nothing about any of this until after he died. And when he left the hospital, he was given an aftercare directive where they listed all the things that he had to agree to avoid going into Anoka Hospital. And one of those things that he had to agree to was to attend all CAFE study meetings. The doctor involved in this knew that I certainly did not want my son in a clinical study. I did not want him to be on one of three drugs where he or I would have no idea what they were, where he or I would have no idea what the dosage was going to be, and as I knew in a clinical study, nobody is removed because they don't do well. I had talked to the study coordinator on many occasions telling her, Dan is not doing well. What do we have to do to get him out of the study? And she said, well, Mary, if he's not doing well, of course they'll take him out. And over the months, he deteriorated. It got to the point on Easter Sunday, which was April 11th of 2003, where Dan was totally psychotic. And I called the doctor, I called his case manager, and I called the study coordinator, leaving messages on their phone on that day, thinking that they would understand that because I called on Easter Sunday, it was really a very dire circumstance and would call me back the next day. No one called back for a week later. And then it was the study coordinator who said, well, I'm sorry, Mary, despite what I told you, I have no control over the drugs. And it was less than a month after that that Dan killed himself. And in the sudden adverse event report form that they had to do to AstraZeneca, the pharmaceutical company involved in this, they wrote that over the last few months, Dan's ADLs, which is activities of daily living, things like being able to take care of yourself, changing your clothes, which Dan didn't do for actually months on end, and they said his ADLs had deteriorated. Yet he would not be allowed out of the study. And I thought over the last almost 5 years, you know, what more could I have done. I even asked his case manager to help get Dan out of the study, and on more than one occasion, his case manager said, "Oh, don't you think he's doing well? I played pool with him last week," as though that is an indication of somebody doing well. And it's too late for Dan now, but yet I have promised Dan that I will fight for the rights of the mentally ill until the day I die. You know, here's a bit of irony. If you think about it, there are as many people with a serious mental illness as there are women who have breast cancer. And I certainly don't begrudge any of the research on breast cancer. I think it's fantastic. And I hope they find a cure. But on the other hand, mental illness really strikes all of us in one way or another, whether it's our immediate family, a neighbor, a cousin, a grandmother, whether it's somebody on antidepressants or antipsychotics. You know, we're told, oh, you know, he or she isn't taking their meds and that they're fine if they take their meds. I ultimately want to see research done into helping find a cure, and there can be a cure for mental illness. But right now, what I want to see is that no other family has to go through what I went through and has to lose a child totally unnecessarily. The University of Minnesota themselves put out a very good page on their website. You can, I have a copy for all of you. It's under their Office of Clinical Research. And they've just redone this, thankfully, in the last 2 years, and I'd like to read to you what they say. The question, is participating in a study a good way to get free health care? And they say, it depends. Clinical research differs from clinical care in important ways. The goal of clinical care is to improve the health or comfort of one person. The goal of research is to produce reliable knowledge. The individual patient benefits from clinical care. Future patients and the community at large benefit from research. A healthcare provider applies the best known therapies to improve his or her patient's welfare. A researcher does not, and even, now my word is even, does not even know whether the medicine or procedure he or she is studying is effective. And I assume a lot of you here are parents. And I find it hard to believe that anybody here, if their child were put into a stay of a civil commitment, that they would be willing to let them go into a clinical study. When on the other hand, they could be given one of these three drugs, or maybe no drug at all, and they would have an individual doctor who would care about Dan Markingson and talk to Dan Markingson maybe every 2 weeks to see how he's doing and to either lower or increase his medication. In fact, Dan's medication was increased to the very limit that this medication, which is Seroquel, can be taken. He was taking 800 milligrams. And had he been treated by a regular psychiatrist, I believe that he would have been kept on the drug that he was initially put on in the hospital, which was Risperdal at a very low dose. They would not have extended his medication to the utmost just so they could compare him with patient B to see who fared better. And this bill is going to protect many people in the future. Like I said, it is too late for Dan, but he has definitely told me that he wants me to work to help prevent this from happening to anybody else. And I also have what I'm going to give you copies of, which I mentioned the form that the doctor fills out. And the Ombudsman's Office, and I'd just like to read this to you because it is very important. Capacity to give informed consent must be based on your understanding of your current condition, the reason for your hospitalization, and whether or not you believe you have a mental illness. When somebody is given a court order, and the court order is very much a template, they just changed the names. Probably before Dan, it was Sue Abbott or somebody. But they are ordered to get treatment. To me, this bill is very simple. And there probably will be those who contest it that I don't know. And I know NAMI has done much to promote mental health, and for that I salute them. And I most heartily hope that they will be with us when they think about the ramifications of this bill, and that it may in fact someday affect their loved ones.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Howard, and I'm a close friend of Mary Weiss's and a close friend of, or was a close friend of Dan Markington. I guess I would just like to just take a few quick moments for you. I'd like to echo everything that Mary said, and I think something that I just spoke with Representative Carla Bingham earlier this week about is, I know there's been a lot of talk and stuff about the Vulnerable Adults Act in Minnesota and strengthening some provisions of that. And I think it's very applicable to this very bill today. You know, we have concerns about people suffering from dementia and different forms of mental illness, and we're looking to safeguard their rights, protection, maybe stop them from being coerced into a car loan or a house loan or something like that. And in actuality, what happened to Dan Markington is along the very same border. It's the same principle. He actually signed a contract, a consent form, a legal document to go into a study, and he certainly did not have the capacity to do that. And there was a certain amount of coercion involved, and I believe it's the same principle. This bill is along those same lines, so I would heartily hope that people would, you know, take a hard look at that and try to accept that, that it's the same principle needs to be applied here. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, we have the Mental Health Ombudsman, Roberta Opine, to testify on the bill, too.
Thank you.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roberta Opine. I'm the State Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. The Office of Ombudsman has as its mission to promote the highest attainable standards of treatment, competency, efficiency, and justice. We also operate what's called...
It'll be about 5 minutes if we could.
Right.
Thank you.
We also operate Civil Commitment Training and Resource Center and conduct medical reviews of deaths and serious injuries of persons who are receiving treatment. I want to focus today on a very, very narrow focus, and that is the concept of informed consent. We are not opposed to research. In fact, we applaud research, and we hope that all of these companies continue to develop these life-saving drugs. We are never in a position to want to say that simply because someone has a mental illness that they don't have the right to make individual choices, whether we agree or disagree with those choices. By no means are we saying that. What we are talking about here is simply the threat of the loss of liberty and what that subtle message does when you are making a decision. Whether or not anyone coerces you or not, there's always the threat. Civil commitment is a non-voluntary process. It says, we will take your liberty away from you unless you agree to certain things. It's always adversarial, it's always coercive, because if it's not, civil commitment is a court process, and if a person's willing to do it voluntarily and has insight, you don't need the court process. So it's adversarial. They go in there, and They're either going to lose their liberty unless they agree to a stay, if that's even appropriate. And the stay says, you must follow all the recommendations of your treatment team or else you will lose your liberty. Therefore, what the doctor says has the weight of law behind it. Even if the doctor's nice, coercive, and fully explains it, it leaves you with the impression that if I don't agree to do what they say, I'm going to lose my liberty. There's also the issue of whether it's appropriate treatment or not. You have to treat someone, if you're going to commit them or stay the commitment, you have to treat them for their medical mental health condition. People respond differently to different meds. I might respond to Seroquel, someone else responds to Risperidol. And that, so if I'm put on Seroquel, the ability to switch me if it's not working is critical. But a study wants to keep someone longevity for comparison. So those are some of the complications. It's also complicated for the researcher because you want someone in your study who may be gaming you. I'll say whatever the court wants, just not to be committed. And I'll say I'm doing whatever you want me to do, just not to be committed. And so it's a complicator on both sides. We want research. I never want to end a person's right to choose for themselves. That is paramount in my business, and I believe in it with all my heart and soul. But if they really can make an informed choice to be in the study, then drop the stay of commitment. But when there's a court order hanging over your head with a civil rights issue, we don't want the court being the medical decision maker. We want them to be the arbiter of civil rights.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, next is Mr. Carl Elliott. Today, if you've seen the Pioneer Press, there's an op-ed piece regarding the bill. And so I just would like him to say some words.
Hi, my name is Carl Elliott. I teach medical ethics at the University of Minnesota and have been working on research ethics for about 15 years now, especially ethics of psychiatric drug trials. To be honest, I don't think this is a controversial bill. I don't think it ought to be controversial. Essentially, what it's saying is that if a person is mentally ill, and they are dangerous to themselves or to other people, then they don't belong in a research study. They need to get proven treatment. I just want to make three points about this. The first thing to realize is that this bill just puts into law what a lot of psychiatric drug trials already say themselves. If you look at trials of new antipsychotic drugs, which are the kinds of drugs these populations are most likely to be getting. If you look at these trials, you'll see that most of them already say you can't recruit patients into these studies if they're at risk of suicide or if they're at risk of violence to other people. Trial guidelines say that already. And they say that because there's always a danger that a patient in a clinical trial is going to get worse in the trial. And the last kind of patient you want to risk getting worse is one who's at risk of suicide or violence, because that's the kind of risk that if it happens, it can't be fixed. Second thing to realize is any drug study carries risks. Sometimes the risks are very small. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes subjects are given drugs that don't work. Sometimes they're given drugs that make them worse. Sometimes they're given drugs that have side effects that are worse than their illness. Sometimes the drugs are tested against placebos. And so a subject who enrolls in those studies is at the risk of getting no treatment at all. All of which means that being in a research study is different from getting treatment. If a patient is being given standard treatment, standard therapy for their illness outside a research study, and it's not working, you can just try something else. You can change their drug. You can add another drug. You can do whatever you think is in that patient's best interest. If they're in a study, there are constraints on what you can do. You have to follow the study guidelines. And those guidelines may say, for example, patient has to stay on a single drug for 6 months. If you want to change their treatment, you have to drop them from the study. Third thing to realize is an issue about informed consent. If you look at any code of research ethics, from the Nuremberg Code to the Declaration of Helsinki, you will see that informed consent is the cornerstone of the code. Subjects have to know what they're signing up for, and they've got to agree to do it without coercion and without pressure. That's what informed consent means. And that's exactly what's missing with patients under a commitment order. First of all, they're mentally ill, which means they may well not know what they're signing up for. Second, their consent is hardly free when the alternative to signing up for a research study is involuntary commitment to a mental institution. So the bottom line here is, this is a good bill. It's a very good bill. These patients are vulnerable. They need protection, and I think this bill will help make sure that happens.
Representative Weaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Elliott, I thank you for your testimony. And Representative Bingham, thank you for bringing this forward. I think this is an extremely serious issue, and I think you'll probably have the votes to pass it. But I do just want to ask a couple of things that aren't clear to me from this. Dr. Elliott, when there are drug studies that are not psychiatric drug studies, are there the same kind of restrictions that if a patient isn't doing well, that they still have to continue on the treatment? I mean, I'm kind of surprised by that. It just seems very weird to me that, you know, that if somebody is individually not doing well, that because they're under a study protocol, that they have to be continued. That just seems unethical. What's going on there?
It depends on the study protocol. The study protocol will set out what constraints you have. If you think a patient is not doing well in the study, you can always drop them from the study and give them standard treatment outside the study. And there are a variety of different kinds of studies. There may well be studies in which you can add drugs or make alterations to the treatment. But that'll be written into the clinical trial. So it depends on the trial itself.
Okay, well, Mr. Sharon, thank you for explaining that. It just, it just seems like, I don't know why we permit or why the institutional review boards, that's what they're called, right, why they would permit a study where somebody who's not doing well would be permitted to remain in the study, you know, that... That just seems very odd to me in the first place. But anyway, I also wanted to just ask you, it seems like there are a number of different things going on here. One is this inability to really consent, and I totally get that. But is there a circumstance, can you think of any circumstance in which being in a clinical trial might be helpful for a patient? I mean, in the other world of other kinds of treatments, sometimes people participate in trials because that's the only way to get a treatment that seems to be the only thing that will help them. And then if that is a possible thing, maybe what we need to think about is how to have somebody else help them with the consent issue. I mean, I certainly think it's a problem to have a person in this situation being asked to consent, but... You know, couldn't you have a guardian or something?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Elliott, Representative Bingham.
And Representative Liebling. You're only prohibited, according to my bill, you'd be prohibited only while on the state commitment. And so if your state commitment is for 6 months or whatever, that's when you couldn't be on the psychiatric clinical drug trial. But after that, you would be, willing, and if you were willing and able to participate in any of those psychiatric clinical drug trials, but I'll let Mr. Elliott add anything, or Ms. Opine, if you have any.
I would say, yes, absolutely. There are cases where you might be better off in a clinical trial. There are all kinds of reasons why people might want to get in to enroll in a clinical trial. It may be that standard therapy is not working for them. They want to try something new. It may be that standard therapy works, but it has side effects which are burdensome to them. It may be that the mode of administration is burdensome to them, and they would rather have... So there are all kinds of reasons to want to get into a clinical trial, to get access to drugs that may well work, but which are not available to you outside the trial. So I wouldn't want to leave the impression that all clinical trials are dangerous, but some are.
Definitely.
And
yeah. No, that's fine. Yeah, think well, the other issue about consent, I guess, is the thing that didn't get covered.
Follow up on that. Then, I mean, if there are drugs, this would not let that patient get into that drug trial, though. So, if it would be beneficial, the way this language is written, that patient couldn't, under any circumstances, get to that option. And so what you just said may be inconsistent with the language of the bill. I just wanted to...
Mr. Chair and members, the perspective that I have, I agree that my concern is not, or I don't want to limit people from some of what we read about experimental treatment at the end of life, where they choose it because the standard course of treatment is not going to prevail. And so when I talked to the author, I spoke specifically about we don't want to prohibit them if they're mentally ill but also have cancer from being able to do that, which I believe is part of the reason the scope was limited to psychotropic drugs, psychiatric drugs. And my point is simply then, take them out of the stayed commitment and allow them to make an informed decision to join or not join the study. It's the threat of coercion that even if everyone is doing their job, says, if I don't do what this person says, I'm going to lose my liberty. That's the threat. You know, I don't want to keep people from experimental treatment when it is the only option left. But then perhaps a different alternative is to require the court to make the determination whether the person had the ability to inform consent, such as Jarvis or Price-Shepherd or some of the alternative court processes. But it's the implied threat that is of concern to me, yes. Not the experimentation and research on drugs.
No, I think I'll leave this there.
NAMI testify and get this issue as well. Thank you very much. It's admirable.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sue Abdeholman, Executive Director of NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. When we kind of talk about hope with any serious illness, whatever it is, we usually turn to research. Many people, you know, look to research for finding something new for a cure, whether it's, you know, brain cancer, breast cancer, and it includes serious mental illness. There have been a lot of developments over the last 10 years, including in terms of medication and other treatment, that have really helped people become better. What we see, and we had a long debate in our organization about this, and Mary, we're, you know, certainly, you know, as you know, very sorry for the loss of your son. You know that. But we see people who are treatment resistant, where they've tried everything under the sun and nothing seems to really work. And we've seen people who have difficulty with the side effects of the particular medications. You know, and as many of you know, when you're trying to find something that works, it can take years to find the right medication and the right combination of medications. And I've seen that within my own family. A lot of the research that goes on right now helps us understand better about which medications work better with which people. You know, some things work better with men, some things with women, you know, particular medication for a certain type of illness. What NAMI is concerned about this particular bill, the way that it's written, is that you have to understand that when someone is committed, they don't lose their rights to make decisions. They got to a point where they said you need to be committed and you need to have this treatment, but they can still vote, they can still sign contracts, they can still do all of those kinds of things. Now, we will admit that sometimes people in this situation, and not all, because people are committed not just because they're in danger of hurting themselves or others, but also because they can't care for themselves. And as they, you know, get treatment, they get better. But they still may have trouble with the side effects, or they may still have rapid cycling that's not going away. What we would have preferred to have seen is that that we put some added protections in there instead of just doing a blanket wiping out of anyone's ability to participate. One thing I just want to mention is some people are on stays of commitment for a long period of time. One of our members who's testified here before, her son has been committed on and off pretty much continuously for the last 10 years. He's very treatment resistant, and this would actually prevent him from participating. The things that we would have recommended is that, one, the psychiatrist who is doing the research cannot also be the committing psychiatrist, so that you're setting up and making sure that there's not really a conflict of interest there. The other thing we would say is that you can't participate in a placebo study, because clearly that's not treatment, and so we wouldn't want that to happen. And the other thing is for people to be assigned a patient advocate that's not part of that particular research team, but is outside, so that could really help the person. You know, when someone's on a stay of commitment, you know, and even committed inside the hospital, that person still gets the right to say, we don't want our family to be involved at all. We don't want them to know anything. We don't want them to see the records. We don't even want them to know that we're here. So, you know, I realize this is a really difficult situation. It really is a balancing act. If we decide that commitment should really be, you know, taking away people's rights to make decisions, then we should really be upfront about that. If we think they're too vulnerable to make those decisions. So it's not that we're, you know, that we think the way everything is now is, you know, hunky-dory. We do think it would be good to add some extra protections in, but this seems like a really wide stroke. And when nothing is working, why would you deny someone the opportunity to see if something might work?
Representative Bingham.
Thank you. A couple things, and thanks, Sue, for coming up. I didn't say they don't have rights. What I'm saying is they don't have the capacity to know what they're getting into. And
is that always true?
Mr. Chairman, that isn't always true.
And the only other thing I would say, Mr. Chair, is that a lot of the things that Ms. Aberholden mentioned is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the URD does a lot of those protocols. And what happened here is that didn't work. And I'm not saying that people can't ever be on these, just in these, participate in the psychiatric clinical drug trials. All I'm saying is, while you're on the stage of a commitment for that time, please get well. Please know, please get the treatment. Please know what you're going to be entering in. So it's not like I'm prohibiting forever people to participate in this.
No, and my only thoughts on this, and you know, I think we should, well, I'm going to vote to move this on, but I would just say, I'm just wondering if there's a little bit of a more nuanced approach here that would allow for people where they actually could get help from these clinical trials and other stuff isn't working, and they have the capacity to consent, whether there'd be a possibility within this process of allowing that to happen.
Okay. I think what you have to do is weigh the possibility, you know, for the large population who might enroll in these trials, you have to weigh the possibility that they might benefit versus the possibility that they might get much worse. And the vast majority of these trials are done for drugs that never make it to market. So the possibility that you're going to get a drug, a psychiatric drug, through a clinical trial that fixes your problem is very, very remote. A large proportion of these trials are simply marketing trials done, testing one drug against the other, looking for some small marketing advantage of one over than the other one. Way over against that, the possibility that someone who has been involuntarily committed because they're judged at danger of killing themselves or of killing somebody else, weigh that danger against the possibility that they might get worse in the trial. That, I think, is the danger of that far outweighs the likelihood that someone's going to get really good treatment in these trials.
Presumably.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to kind of clarify something. Mrs. Aberholden, you said that they could be on a commitment for a long time, but you're not talking about the stay of commitment. That's what we're dealing with here, and as I'm understanding it from Representative Bingham, that's just a six-month period, no more. Am I right about that?
Representative Bingham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, unless they're not doing well, then it could be renewed. Then it could be lengthened, of course. I mean, that's just like we serve on public safety together. Just like if somebody's on probation and they revoke, you know, you could have to go back and serve your whole sentence. Although I don't like to make those comparisons. Yeah.
Representative, we've known people who've been on, you know, continued stays for years. So it's not necessarily just a 6 month. You know, even if you were just to say that this is prohibited unless approved by the court, so that if somebody, you know, you could have someone who's really, you know, not able to really care for themselves very well, but still able to make decisions. We've been talking so much about treating mental health as regular health care, you know, and it just seems like we're just kind of really pulling this out differently. And, you know, having had family members who really struggled finding the right medication, I just think that this blanket approach, when you have people who really struggle with this illness and finding, you know, I think it's more than just, you know, well, we're going to compare it for a marketing reason. We have found that certain medications work better for some people than others because you've done these kinds of trials where you've done a comparison. So at least give people the opportunity to get it approved by the court, to make sure they're not being coerced, to make sure someone's doing oversight. But, you know, this blanket just really seems unfair to people who really struggle.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. And I think there's a lot to consider here. But I have to say, as I'm kind of listening to this, and I don't have any real experience in this area or anything, I'm kind of persuaded by the coercion factor here that was mentioned. You know, you could go back to the court, but I'm not sure the court is the best arbiter of this kind of thing. And the court, after all, is the very entity that's going to be deciding whether this person really gets committed or is on the stay. And I think that's a really serious issue, that even if the person's competent, that there really is a coercion factor here, because your stay could be yanked. And I'm kind of thinking that I think it was Representative Bingham who said that if the person, for example, wanted to be in a clinical trial, what would stop them from going back to the court and saying, take me off the stay because I am voluntarily going to participate in this clinical trial? Would there be an impediment to doing that if the person felt that the only way they could, for example, get on a particular treatment was through doing a clinical trial?
Ms.
I'd rather have the commitment attorney talk about that. Okay. I don't think that gets to that.
All right. Well, let's answer that. We can, a brief answer on that if we can.
Really quickly, Chair and members,
and because this is partly an issue for the next committee as well.
Right. And I'm not a commitment attorney, but I don't think there's anything that prevents them from going back into court, and all the parties agree. Caseworker thinks, yeah, this is a good issue. The person wants to do it. The doctor's recommending it. It is the fact of the threat of the loss of liberty. I will tell you, I have clients who run to other states, and they know which states don't have the interstate compact because they are so scared to death of being yanked back into the hospital because of the course of nature. And they are not sophisticated in the law. They don't know about .17 hearings. They don't know about the medical side of this. I'm not impugning the researchers at all, because Sue and I think, absolutely agree on the critical nature of research. And we, too, had the very same debate within our office. And all I'm asking is you remove the coercion factor.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I know I've gone over well over my allotted time. I apologize.
Oh, no. They were our questions. Representative Bunn.
Very, very briefly, Mr. Chair, there was some reference made by Ms. Weiss early on that raised a different level of the question regarding possible role of conversion. This is a little bit of a tangent, but just a very brief answer on the issue of, did her son's status in terms of not having insurance or having insurance, there was some mention in looking at the University of Minnesota documents in terms of win-win-win use in clinical trial versus other types of treatment, that sometimes clinical trials are chosen as ways to get treatment covered. And I was a little alarmed by hearing that phrase in there as to whether or not your son's insurance status or lack thereof had any role in either the commitment decision, the stay decision, or the choice to pursue a particular decision along this way or having to do with the trial, because otherwise it wasn't clear how their treatment would be covered financially.
Okay, Dan did actually have health insurance,
okay,
and it was through Health Partners.
Mm-hmm.
And after his death, we did find out from them that they would not have paid for experimental research, as any research really is. It's experimental in that you don't know how it's going to turn out. But I don't think that had a bearing on whether he went into the study. You know, it really boils down to the coercion factor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was coerced, and this is continuing.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Bunn.
One final, and back to your other thread that you had pursued for a while there, the issue of whether this goes too far and doesn't allow the clinical. I do have extended family members that have had severe mental illness, including psychotic drugs, including two suicides. So I have some exposure to all this. And listening to the two examples, the one of your son, it sounded like it was a first episode, a very serious episode. Why they would be doing a clinical trial on a first episode is beyond me, number one. Every possible already tested, approved method should have been pursued for long periods of time before anyone like him, in my view, should ever have been exposed to a clinical trial of any kind. On the other hand, the case of the 10 years of recommitments and therapies not working, there might be a spot in there where that person would be should avail themselves to a clinical trial. But it should ask after every FDA-approved, you know, evidence-based other approach has been tried. So I think building in some outlet, if not adequate yet in your bill, for that instance is would be good to do. And I think we can be worked on in the future if it's not already there. But I think in your instance, based on my life experience and exposure to issues, I can't imagine why this occurred in this situation. And thank you for being here today to bring this to our attention.
I do want to mention that in the court order, it indicates that the individual can go to the court to ask that the court order be dropped. And so if it were a case where there was psychiatric medication, a new one, if the new one came out that this person wanted to try and was not available, they could go to the court without any change in this bill and ask that I be released from my stay. And I think one other thing we have to remember is that clinical trials are huge business. The doctor that put Dan into the study was paid over $1,500 each time Dan went to a cafe study. And I'll also just add that the day Dan died, May 8th, that they were paid for a visit 19. He never went to a visit 19. He went to 11. And it's unfortunate that this has become big business,
mm-hmm,
rather than treating the patient. I also want to mention that most psychiatric drug studies, and you can go to clinicaltrials.gov and find all of them, most of them being done for psychiatric drugs are phase 4 studies. The first three phases of a study is pre-approval. And then there is what's called a phase 4 study. And my big question is, why after these drugs, olanzapine, risperdal, Seroquel, have been approved for a dozen years, are they still even doing clinical studies on these drugs, if not for marketing?
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Can I make one?
Yes, you
okay.
can.
I just wanted to thank Lynn, for all your help on this. This has been a 2-year thing, and she's done a lot of drafts and amendments and stuff like that. So I just wanted to thank her publicly for that.
All right. Well, thank you. We don't do that enough.
Yeah.
All right, any further discussion? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 388, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, the committee, for being indulgent.
Okay. We are going to take up Representative Fritz's bill now because she has another committee to get to. It's House File 5, Senate File 594, I guess, now. This passed the House, the Senate, off the Senate floor?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, it has gone to the floor in the Senate. Passed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for having us here today. That was the Senate File 594. This is House File 921. And what this bill, I'd like to move it.
Right, so the motion is on Senate File 594, that it be recommended pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Well, actually...
they've requested it.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Sorry.
Okay.
And it does require enforcement by the Commerce Commissioner.
Okay. Yes, it does. All right. I guess that's where it'll go then. All right. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, this bill before you expands the application of the existing Safe Patient Handling Act to unlicensed healthcare facilities such as physicians and dental offices. The current statute required the establishment of a work group to determine the ability to expand coverage of the Safe Patient Handling Act to other healthcare facilities. A report form from that group was provided to the 2008 legislature. The bill before you is consensus language developed by that work group. The bill differs from requirements of the existing statute in that it does not require the establishment of a safe patient handling committee. The bill requires that the covered clinical settings develop a written safe patient handling plan by July 1st, 2010 to achieve the goal of minimizing manual listing of patients by direct care workers by utilizing safe patient handling equipment by January 1st, 2012. The bill has two equally important goals: to reduce injuries to direct patient care workers and to increase access for individuals with disabilities to health care facilities. Joining me today is Carrie Morse, who is a representative of the Minnesota Nurses Association, and Margot Cross, Accessibility Specialist for the Minnesota State Council on Disability. I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Carrie Morchard, and I'm a registered nurse in the Governmental Affairs Department with the Minnesota Nurses Association. And the Minnesota Nurses Association represents over 21,000 RNs in the state. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of House File 921, amending the 2007 Minnesota Safe Patient Handling Act. Section 37 of the statute established a work group which was charged with determining the ability to expand coverage to other outpatient care settings. Members of the work group included representatives of the Minnesota Medical Association, the Dental Association, Medical Office Managers Association, the Minnesota Disability Council, and representatives of other disability groups. Betty Shogren, MNA staff for health and safety, and I represented the Minnesota Nurses Association. The meetings were held at the Gillette Hospital Outpatient Clinic in St. Paul, and the work group met during the fall of 2007 and winter of 2008. This was especially convenient because the Gillette facility was able to demonstrate the types of equipment necessary to accommodate the needs of people with disabilities and also provide a tour of its outpatient clinic where the equipment was being used. The results of those meetings is this language, House File 921. And as Representative Fritz mentioned, a full report was sent to the legislature in the 2008 session. Worker injuries in the clinical settings may not have reached the level of injuries seen in hospitals and long-term care settings yet, but they do exist. As the population ages and more care is shifted to outpatient areas, the injuries are expected to rise. The numbers are also lower because at present, many people with disabilities cannot access care due to the lack of appropriate equipment to help the person do something as basic as getting on to the exam table. M&A is concerned with the injuries that occur when staff manually lift, transfer, and position patients, but we are equally concerned with the lack of access to care. There is a wide range of equipment available. What's needed in most situations is a high-low exam table and or a lift of some sort. This lift could be an overhead lift or a portable floor lift. The numbers and types of equipment needed would be based on an evaluation of the patient population served by that facility. Evaluation of the patient population and decisions about the equipment would be made at each facility in a manner consistent with the amended statute. The United States Veterans Administration has developed an education and training toolkit, which is inclusive of clinic and other outpatient care settings. M&H staff Betty Sogren was privileged to be part of that work group that developed the toolkit, and we know it will be extremely helpful to employers. This will be available to the public at no charge in April of this year. There are also tax credits and tax deductions available when these types of products are purchased, which can provide substantial savings to the facility. There's also the potential of increased demand for service from those who have not been able to access care in the past. The Minnesota Nurses Association strongly supports this bill and asks for your support. Thanks again for the opportunity to testify.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Margot Imbick Cross, and I'm here today to testify in support of House File 921. This bill addresses two critical issues: access to health care for individuals with disabilities, specifically mobility impairments, and reducing injuries of direct patient workers. Individuals with mobility disabilities, including many older individuals, often forego annual examinations, diagnostic examinations, and sometimes treatment because of inaccessible clinical settings. In my capacity at the State Council on Disability, I conducted an informal survey of several wheelchair users and asked them when was the last time they'd undergone an annual physical examination. The responses ranged from 3 years to 16 years, and when asked why they had waited so long, every one of them indicated the number one reason was they couldn't get on the exam table. This bill requires clinics throughout the state to address this important issue with a plan that minimizes manual lifting and maximizes lifting equipment, and requires important initial and ongoing training of staff on the use of the equipment. I've spoken with grant makers about providing grants to clinics who want to purchase lift equipment. I've been informed by these grant makers that their portfolios are not as robust as they were in years past, but that they do expect that there will be monies available for these types of grants. And so we're going to be working on that. And as Terry indicated in her testimony, the federal government does provide both tax credits and deductions to covered entities that remove barriers. The cost to many clinics would clearly be negligible, and while the benefit would be great. Thank you, and I urge your support.
Yeah. Any questions, members? Anybody in the audience who wants to testify on this one? Okay. Representative Fisher, renew her motion that House File, Senate File 594 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Representative Hayden. He's in the hall. Okay. Not yet. Yeah. He's got to get somewhere too. Yeah, so I would like to do that, but here. All right. And we're going to actually start, I think, with House File 1239. So Representative Hayden will move that House File 1239 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. That's a GRA bill.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair and members. HS 1239 is a bill to help individuals move to employment and self-sufficiency. Organizations that organizations that work have been working together to end long-term homelessness have identified a distinctive. Can't read the script. Have identified a disincentive to seek work amongst individuals with mental illness like chemical addictions who become stabilized after they've been successfully housed. They want to seek employment and be self-sufficient, but they run up against program eligibility requirements that threaten their housing. GRH, or Group Residential Housing Support, is available to a person who is eligible for general assistance, GA, income support due to a disabling condition that prevents the person from obtaining gainful employment. If the person ventures out to seek employment, they run the risk of losing their housing before they become self-supporting. The GA income cash benefit is $101 per month. It does not take much income to eliminate the GA eligibility and therefore lose the GRH housing benefit and become homeless again. HS 1239 will change the GRH eligibility to allow individuals to keep the GRH housing support for up to 12 months for those who begin working and earn more than the GA income benefit. Once the individual earns more than $760 per month, that's the GRH benefit amount, the GRH program will no longer pay for the housing and the individual will be self-supporting. So I have Kathy Timbrook here today, who manages the effort of both Hennepin County and the City of Minneapolis to end homelessness, to talk about this bill a little bit.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Kathy Tenbrook. I'm the coordinator to end homelessness in Minneapolis and Hennepin County. As many of you know, we do have a community plan in Minneapolis and Hennepin County focused on ending homelessness for men, women, children, and youth. We're in 2 years into our implementation of this plan, and we've learned a great deal about the efforts that are most effective and also some of the challenges and barriers that families and individuals are experiencing. Two major goals of our plan are to assist people in accessing safe and stable housing, and also to build families and individuals' abilities to support themselves whenever possible. Group residential housing, or GRH, has been enormously effective, an enormously valuable tool for housing people who are experiencing homelessness, particularly those that are suffering from serious and persistent mental illnesses or some other kind of disabling condition. However, after hearing from many of our housing partners, we realized that while GRH is so critically important, it does not provide any incentive at all for someone to move off of the program and into employment. Many of the participants in these housing programs have talked about their desire to return to work in the future. Many could benefit from more incentives and transition options to return to work, and we'd like to see that their time in this GRH program is really an opportunity to get stable and to get healthy, to get some additional training or education, and if their disability is a permanent one, then to assist them in receiving social supplemental security income. So here's just a very quick hypothetical example, and I hope it illustrates sort of the issue and what this bill would do. Let's say someone is housed through the GRH program because of an untreated serious and persistent mental illness. They're eligible for general assistance because they're unable to work. This makes them eligible for GRH housing. But after being housed, they receive regular mental health treatment and services, they get on appropriate medications, and their lives start to stabilize. With their illness stabilized, they now have the desire to begin to do at least some amount of work in the community. They may not be quite able to work full-time or go off completely on their own, but they'd really like to begin doing part-time work and contribute to supporting themselves. Currently, there's a built-in disincentive for them to work their way off of GRH. If they begin to work and make as little as $300 a month, they will no longer be eligible for general assistance, which will make them ineligible for group residential housing, which means they'll lose their housing. So our intent, as you know, folks who are working to end homelessness, is certainly to encourage self-support, but it's hard to do that when there's such a risk involved for folks when they're going to lose their housing. So this legislation would allow this individual to work for 12 months or until they reach the income eligibility limit of group residential housing, which Representative Hayden mentioned, before they would lose their housing. So they could work for 12 months and basically work off of group residential housing. This time would allow them to save money for alternative housing. Within these 12 months, they'd either become self-supporting and move off of GRH altogether, or they would likely be certified as permanently disabled. In other words, unable to earn enough money to be able to be self-supporting, and therefore then they'd be eligible for SSI. So once again, thank you for this opportunity. I think as the coordinator to end homelessness, I strongly believe that this change to GRH would increase people's self-confidence, their self-esteem, their ability to contribute in additional ways in their community. But it would also help people transition off of programs that they may not need indefinitely. And I think this is especially important for some of the homeless young adults that we're seeing who are eligible for DRH because they are suffering from a mental health issue. But we certainly don't want to see these kids sort of stay unemployed and stay in the house, this kind of a program, unless they would absolutely have to. And so this bill really encourages people to move on and out of the system.
President Scottwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Ms. Timber, how many people would this impact? I mean, what sort of numbers are we looking at, people who fall into this kind of gap? And we've heard this with other public assistance programs where people have a disincentive because the drop-off is so sharp that they end up losing what they need to get back on their feet.
Exactly. Great. Thank you. I would like to ask Dwayne Elves from the state who runs the program to answer that question.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dwayne Elg. I work in the Community Partnerships Division of the Department of Human Services. There are currently 3,700 people who receive group residential housing based on a GA eligibility in the group residential housing program. This particular legislation is based on our experience with about 200 people who are long-term homeless that have been taken off the streets of Minneapolis in Hennepin County and provided independent housing. So that's the sample that we're looking at. This has been anecdotal. This notion has been around anecdotally for some time, but now we have very clear evidence that this is, in fact, a disincentive with this particular group of people. Housing itself appears to be treatment for many who, you know, on the street, their life is in chaos. They come in and they stabilize, and they finally have some autonomy and independence that they otherwise never had. And they are able, you know, there are some who are able then to work. Most of the people in GRH are not, that are on a basis of eligibility that is general assistance. But certainly there are some. And it just makes sense that if we're going to move them to a state of independence, create taxpayers, if you will, that this would be a good piece of legislation.
President Gabel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm curious about is how many statewide, too. I realize this is Minneapolis, but we have more. The 3,700 is a statewide number, correct?
That's correct, yes.
And then the 200 you mentioned, long-term homeless, that you're trying to address here, that's Minneapolis specific. Do we have more elsewhere in the state than...
Mr. Chair, we do have more homeless throughout the state, you know, based on the Wilder research. To give you some idea, there are 18,000 people on general assistance in the state. Their average length of time on general assistance is just over a year now, whereas a few years ago it was about 6 months. So general assistance typically reflects the economy, the status of the economy. And so we fully expect in a short order there'll be 19,000 people and that they'll be on general assistance for a year and a half. So the impact on the bigger problem is pretty small in terms of this legislation, but it certainly, I think, is appropriate.
Okay. So just so I understand this, there's a large category of people that qualify for GRH funding for a whole variety of categorical reasons. One of the ways you can get in is if you're on general assistance, qualify for general assistance. Everybody else gets up, can stay until they have $700 in income. It's just the people that qualify in that particular category get out when they are, because they end their category at $300 and some. Okay. Thank you. All right.
Now,
any, Representative Norton?
I think this is a worthy goal. I'm a little worried about finding the funding for it, but I think that's for another committee. I do have a question about the concept of allowing them to stay for another year, roughly. Is there any assurance that they will actually put the money away? I mean, I think there would be a temptation to spend money that you have, particularly if you haven't had it for a while. And is there going to be any counseling or any help for people to put the money away so that when the year is up, they actually can sustain? Because it sounds like these may be people not making a whole lot of money, and they will need all of it put away in order to sustain existence in some other kind of housing after the fact. So I just wonder if there was counseling or some sort of guarantee that the money would be safe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, The way the group residential housing program works is that if you are on general assistance and you are receiving the group residential housing benefit, you get $101 in what we call personal needs allowance in group residential housing, case for your housing. As you earn income, you will still only receive $101. And so all your income will be going toward paying for your share of the cost of the group residential housing benefit until such time as you are earning enough to pay your own GRH rate. And so you don't have the option to spend all of the money that you're making. You're going to be self-supporting.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes.
So essentially what Mr. Elgin is saying is that, Representative Norton, that you, the money that you're saving between the, looks like the $300 and the $700, that money doesn't go to the participant or the client. That money goes to the state or the agency who's helping to pay for your services, and that includes housing, meals, and other things that they are doing. So you only get $101 of personal money, irregardless to what you make, until you're off the program, either at $300 or $700. What we hope is that because of the cycling sometimes that happens with this population, that we would, you know, the $700 indicates that people can continue to work and be stable in working before they have to actually make a decision on if they're going to leave. But it doesn't necessarily mean that more money comes into the individual participant's pocket.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Hayden will renew his motion to House File 1239. Will be recommended pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Jim.
Aye. All right. Then, Representative Hayden, House File 681 also is going to go to the Committee on, it will be referred to the Committee on Finance. So the motion would be, under House File 6, this is Representative Hayden, will move the House File 681 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 681 will require the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health to conduct an ongoing public education campaign on HIV. The campaign would be aimed to increase the awareness of HIV transmission and prevention among the general public and to reduce stigma associated with the disease. A toll-free resource and referral service, as well as a website, would be promoted through the campaign messages. An evaluation of the campaign's effectiveness would be required. This bill, for me personally, I've had a lot of people that I've known and even family members that have been affected by HIV, friends and a lot of people in the district that I represent. I think that this is an opportunity for us to eradicate the disease as close as we can by simply making sure that people understand how they acquire it. Government has a responsibility to the state's public health, and HIV is a public health issue. HIV disproportionately impacts communities most vulnerable in our society. Investment in the HIV prevention and education is smart public policy and saves taxpayer dollars in the long run. In a cost-benefit analysis of HIV prevention programs, researchers found that the significant lifetime costs of caring for an HIV-affected individual are far greater than the funding needed to reach the same individual with a prevention message. The study found that even a greatly expanded HIV prevention program in the U.S. could pay for itself through savings in averted medical costs. Another recent study showed that a lifetime cost of HIV treatment can be an upwards of $600,000. For these reasons, I believe strongly that we have a responsibility in protecting the public health of our state, and that each dollar we invest in HIV prevention and education is a dollar well spent. I appreciate your consideration of HF 681, and we have Lorraine Teal, the Executive Director of the Minnesota AIDS Project, and she'll speak about the need for HIV education for the general public and community.
Welcome, Ms. Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Hayden, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Lorraine Teal, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota AIDS Project. The mission of the Minnesota AIDS Project, simply put, is to stop HIV. And we accomplish this through education and awareness raising, services provided for those living with this disease, and finally, through advocacy to ensure that the public receives the education and information they need about this communicable disease and that those living with HIV are treated fairly. Since this disease was first recognized by the Centers for Disease Control over 25 years ago, we have sadly seen a continuing lack of basic public education regarding HIV. Many of us may recall that during the 1980s, awareness about AIDS was everywhere. Whether you ate in a restaurant, visited your doctor, sent your children to school, or took public transport, everyone was worried about AIDS. We saw nightly news reports speculating who would be infected, who would die. In 1985, when Rock Hudson was identified as a casualty to this disease, frankly, we saw almost widespread hysteria. Following that came battle after battle for those infected. Could the young schoolboy from Kokomo, Indiana, Ryan White, be allowed to attend school? After a Minnesota physician was identified as HIV positive, we heard calls for routine testing of all healthcare professionals. And the list of who should we test, how do we know, persists to this day. If you ask many citizens, many of your neighbors about Rock Hudson, you'd be amazed how many people don't know who Rock Hudson was, don't understand what AIDS is. We continue to hear questions. Should we test everybody? What if someone that I work with is HIV positive? Should I worry? Why do we continue to have all of these questions? Simply put, despite all the public dialogue that we've had about AIDS, there was no accompanying public dialogue on how this disease is transmitted, and of equal importance, how it is not transmitted. And that lack of education persists. A wise person once told me that HIV education is a process, not an event. And I'd like to repeat that. It's a process over a lifetime. It's not a single event of somebody telling you about HIV or warning you of the consequences of unprotected sex. We cannot assume that being educated about AIDS once at school or by picking up a brochure in your physician's office that often uses vague terms, that there will be any more lasting effect than we can assume that telling a 10th grader not to smoke will still have the same impact when they're age 25, age 30, age 50. Any more than we can assume that telling people to eat healthy one time in their life will have a long-lasting impact. Just like all public health issues, we cannot rest on the laurels of telling or warning people one time about a threat to their health. Those educational sessions need to occur over a lifetime, and they need to come from many sources. Just like that, we need to do so with HIV education. We know that right here in Minnesota, the numbers are on the rise. While in Minnesota, the HIV infection rates have only increased slightly over the past several years, the number of people living with this communicable disease has grown very rapidly. In fact, since 1997, the number of Minnesotans living with HIV has risen over 80%. In 2007, the number of newly reported infections was the highest it had been since the mid-90s. We are still considered a lower incidence state. We know education works because if it didn't work, we would have seen a tremendous increase in new cases. As I said, we've had a tremendous increase in the number of people living with this disease, yet only a modest increase in the number of new infections. The state health department does currently fund HIV prevention programs, but they target that funding for those communities at highest risk. And what we're talking about here is HIV education for the general public. The impact of HIV in some parts of this world is almost too large to imagine. But right here in Minnesota, we have a growing HIV problem. And we can make a difference. Just 30 years ago, it was not okay to talk about mammograms or breast cancer, colonoscopies, pap smears, or prostate exams. We learned that by not doing so and by remaining silent, all we did was delay diagnosis, create stigma and shame, and family stress. With awareness and education for each of these conditions, today we are fortunately seeing enormous strides in survival rates due to early diagnosis. We don't shy away from educating the community about these diseases, because we understand the importance of early detection. And that's exactly what we're asking for today, an investment in the public education of all Minnesotans about AIDS. This ongoing process of education will accomplish much. It will combat the complacency that currently exists. People will no longer think, I don't need to be tested. It's not a Minnesota problem. It is a Minnesota problem. And importantly, people will learn how HIV is not transmitted, and that desperately needed education will really help the lives of those living with this disease who continue to face stigma each and every time they share their status with others. We know that 25% of those infected with this virus in this state do not know their status. They have not yet been tested. And we want to encourage people to get tested so that we can get them into treatment early. Studies have repeatedly demonstrated that when someone knows they are HIV positive, they take the affirmative steps necessary to reduce risk to others. And lastly, it's this important education about stigma and the fear of AIDS that keeps people from testing. It's precisely what keeps your physician from having a conversation with you or those you care about HIV and the importance of testing. Until we become comfortable talking about clearly what constitutes risk for HIV, just as we are comfortable about talking about what constitutes the need for self-breast examination, we cannot make progress. The CDC has called for making HIV testing and annual physicals as routine a part as completing a blood pressure test or a cholesterol count. But we need to educate the public. Finally, at the Minnesota AIDS Project, we light a candle at our front desk when one of our clients passes away. This past week, we lit the candle twice, both for women. One woman in her 60s, one woman 23 years old. This candle symbolizes their fight against HIV and reminds us of the important work that needs to be done every day and that we need to continue to do every day to ensure that people living with AIDS receive the services they need and that we are working as hard as we can to prevent new infections. Please support this bill so that the number of candles representing Minnesota lives lost to AIDS moves ever closer to zero. This disease is 100% preventable. We know how to stop it. We simply need the tools to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Teal, thank you for your testimony and Representative Hayden for bringing this forward. The state of Minnesota is already funding, I understand, a number of agencies that are about AIDS education, both to at-risk populations as well as the general public. So if we're already spending $6.2 million, and maybe the question isn't, I wonder if we do have anybody from the Department of Health, Mr. Chair, here who could comment on the efforts they're already engaged in. Because one of my concerns, frankly, as he's making his way to the dais, is overlap and
welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and other representatives of the committee. My name is Gary Novotny. I'm employed at the STD HIV section at the Minnesota Department of Health. I hear the question about we're already funding targeted programs and general public education. That's not correct. We do not, none of the funding goes to general public education. The funds that we receive from the state and the CDC require us to spend them on targeted efforts.
Do you have a list of the organizations that you're currently funding? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Novotny, do you have a list of the efforts you're funding? I understand at least one of them is Minnesota AIDS Project, which really is a general public information group, correct?
Okay. I can bring a list. I have provided a handwritten list earlier, but I can supply a list of the agencies and their funding. Minnesota AIDS Project does receive some of the funding. None of the funding they receive from the health department is for general education. Once again, none of the funding that we receive from the CDC or the state of Minnesota goes to general education because we're required not to spend it that way.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Novotny, do you have an idea of how you would use, obviously this is going to require some additional funding, but this is a policy committee. What do you see doing with this bill if it comes forward? What sort of general public education would you see this? Is it something we do in the schools? Is it something we do through TV advertising? Or
sure, thank you for that question, Representative Bullock. It could be spent in a variety of ways. One way that funding has been used to respond to general public education has been hotlines both at the CDC level. A couple of hotlines that existed here at one time that we even funded partially, but we don't fund anymore. So hotlines could be one way. Media campaigns could be another way. There are efforts that we collaborate with the Minnesota Department of Education that include AIDS education in the schools. So there's a little bit of that going on, but that has no funding tied to it. So there are a variety of ways. We have members in the community who participate in the community planning process. That would be an excellent resource to pull on what the best ways would be to do public education.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and sort of in the same direction, I was chatting with Representative Hayden as we were on a different bill, but if this is going to go to finance, and it's just, as you work on this, it's kind of, the bill says it'd be nice if we could do some more of this stuff, and I think if you're actually going to try to get a fiscal note, you're going to have to kind of tell somebody what stuff that it is you want to do. And an ongoing statewide campaign, and that could be modified in a term. The phone that you're going to be using, if it's an existing one, if it's a non-political one, if it's one from a group that has some, you know, history behind it, that would be another thing to know. And then the effectiveness judgments would be, you want to, the more you tell them, the more they'll do. And I don't know how they'd even fiscal know this, but I, just to give you some of the advice along the way.
Representative Abel, thank you. I'll take your advice to heart now. I'll work on that as hard as I can.
All right, Representative Emmer.
Well, that's a good sign. Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, first, this is absolutely what needs to happen. This is a policy committee. Education is what we should be talking about. I would ask you and either one or both of your testifiers, when it comes to the policy, we've had this public-private partnership over the past few years, and Ms. Teal, I'm happy to see you're here because I've always wanted to have this discussion with you. In the department as well, you've had a website, which I think is very important for educational purposes, but the website has, first in the past, has had information on it that's not consistent with what the CDC has suggested is appropriate. And it's got, well, let's say in some cases, the things that have been brought to myself and others, it's not so much the education piece, but it's the method in which it's being delivered, replete with profanity, graphic descriptions of different behaviors, practices. The question is there some way that this policy committee or maybe Representative Hayden for the future as he moves it through can put some policy in place as to what is appropriate within, you know, taxpayers if they're going to support this type of education? And I see right in the bill it talks about the website, which I think is currently up and running, at least it was within the last 2 years. I'm interested to know if there's any policy now in place or if we should be putting one in place in terms of what goes on that website. And then for Mr. Novotny as well, you know, who from the Department of Health screens these and says, yes, you can put our name on it, because it shouldn't just be the funds that are being used for education, but when you when you're putting out a website, and you're here today representing the Minnesota AIDS Project, if you're putting out a website and you're putting information on there that is contrary
to what the CDC has suggested is appropriate. I'm interested to know who approves or reviews it and then allows you to put the Minnesota Department, is it the Department of Health that goes on there? Minnesota Department of Health stamp of approval, because the problem is someone who accesses that website, they don't know. All they see is Minnesota Department of Health and Minnesota AIDS Project. So if you could address those two things, and if I haven't made them too convoluted. And
Mr. Chairman and Representative Emmer, thank you for the opportunity to respond. We're not here today talking about the Minnesota AIDS Project or funding for the Minnesota AIDS Project or funding for a Minnesota AIDS Project website. The website, however, to which you're referring is not the Minnesota AIDS Project. It is a website that we do operate called Pride Alive. It is a website targeted for adult sexually active gay men. That is not what we're referencing today. We're referencing broad-based public health education for the general public in terms that the general public would understand and accept.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, and can I just to clarify now, so the what this would be a different website designed by the Department of Health?
Mr. Chair, to my knowledge, we are promoting this as a policy. How this would be implemented would be funding to the Minnesota Department of Health. They would determine what programs, what types of campaigns. This is not a bill for the Minnesota AIDS Project. We are simply bringing forth to raise awareness on a policy level for the need for good, sound public health education around AIDS.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hill, thank you. I agree with that, the statement that you just made. I think that's a valid mission. What I'm asking, and thank you for clarifying, I didn't know that's what it's called, but the Pride Alive website, it is a website that, as I understand, it was supported in part by income to Minnesota AIDS Project from several sources, including federal government grants and state government grants right out of the Department of Health. And I guess what you raise a concern, because I want to discuss the policy. If you go forward with this, we've got a little of experience based on this Pride Alive site, which you now say it's for adult sexually active gay men. And yet there were no restrictions on that website. Children of any age could access the website. Again, very graphic information contained in the website may be appropriate. I'm not here to judge one way or the other, but education is a mission. I'm just asking, as a matter of public policy, when you're using taxpayer dollars, which is what this would propose, is there some policy in place either at the department, or is this something that should be discussed as this moves along, as to who's going to determine, you know, what types of audiences this is for, how it gets accessed, and the material that's in it? And again, Ms. Teal, if you could address, it's very concerning to people that I heard from that there were things on the Pride Alive website that were in direct conflict with information being promoted by the CDC.
Well, I think the first question is for Mr. Novotny about what the Department of Health. I think it's been clarified that this bill and what you're talking about are different things. But Mr. Novotny.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Mayor. The Centers for Disease Control requires that all materials that are used in the programs, including websites, the materials need to be reviewed by a local AIDS material review board. We review websites as well, and websites need to have on their opening page a warning that the materials contained in this website may be offensive and it's intended for adults only. So all websites that many agencies have, more than the Minnesota AIDS Project, nearly every funded agency has a website, and they're required by the CDC to include that introductory comment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I welcome the opportunity to finally put this issue at rest. You looked at that website in 2005 during a very, very brief period of time where that warning gate that Mr. Novotny just referred to was down because we were doing some maintenance to the website. So The statement that Mr. Novotny referred to has been up consistently since that period of time, telling people that this is a website for adults, that the material that they're about to see is intended for adult sexually active gay men. So I'm not certain that your comments regarding the website is available to children of any age. Certainly they can read that statement and click through, just like they might click through at a Playboy website or any other adult-themed website.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative
Steele, I would have no idea. I only know based on what I was alerted to with your website and with taxpayer dollars. Again, education's the issue. But when you put up a warning that says, warning, this contain adult material, I guarantee you that that's an invitation to some kids that are not mature to actually try and access it. And I guess I'm sorry if it's a sensitive topic, but I think maybe as this goes forward, today we certainly don't have the time, but this is something that should be discussed in terms of how do you put up those protections so that it is only accessible to those parties that it's intended for? I think that's what I was asking.
Representative Hayden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wimmer, I think that you have a point. I think we should have a discussion that's open, that's valid, that doesn't have our own, that allows us to have an open discussion about the intent of the website, what it's for, what it's appropriate, what it should say appropriately, and who its target market is. And so if it's a specific piece of funding that goes towards a specific group of people that we're targeting because they may be the highest users or the folks who contract this disease, I think that there is some language and things that we might want to use to make sure that they understand what we're trying to say and how they can contract this disease. If it is, with this bill, if it's going to be in much broader and wider use, I think that it is appropriate for us to have a good conversation about it and then direct the Department of Health and to make sure, and even to have a sampling of the website up, to make sure that it is, if it's going to go out to the general public and it doesn't have those restrictions, that is going to be appropriate. The intent of this bill and the intent of the education is to prevent people from getting HIV. Unfortunately, the way you contract HIV, sometimes you have to use language or you have to be able to project that in ways that might be offensive to people. Speaking to a person who has a 12-year-old and a 7-year-old, I watch what my children look at on the website. I monitor that. I put in controls so that they can't get that, so if those warnings come up that they can't get through. So there is a certain level of what we have to do as parents to be able to control that. But I am more and more than willing to work on this bill with you and others to make sure that as we spend taxpayer money to get out the message of education so people can't contract this disease, that we do it in a way that is appropriate for the people of Minnesota.
Thank you, Reverend Hayden. We got to move on here. So, and thank you to the testifiers. Reverend Hayden will renew his motion that House File 681 be recommended pass and re-referred to Finance. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you. Representative Lane, is Mr. Baumgartner here yet? And is Representative Abler here right now? All right, I guess I'm up. And Madam Chair, members, not to be selfish here, but we'd like to kind of get to the last two bills quickly, so maybe moving through these real quickly would be great.
Well, Representative Peterson, I don't know now that you've jinxed that one. Okay, well, Representative Peterson, House File 521, is that what we're starting with?
Yes,
first,
ma'am.
Here? Okay. All right. Representative Peterson moves that House File 521 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice.
Representative Peterson, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this legislation really is modifying some legislation that Representative Winkler largely passed or modified last year about how we allow medical professionals in a time of disaster where we need more than we have available to come into the state to help out. And it makes really two changes that are largely practical changes. I'm going to let Judge Davies describe what the bill is trying to do.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Jack Davies. I'm here as the Minnesota Commissioner on Uniform State Laws. We had a bill in last session, and so did the Department of Homeland Security of the state. And since theirs was going along, we got out of the way, and now we've come back to add our little bit from the Uniform Act to that legislation. The that first change it makes in substance is that you don't have to an outstate organization. For example, the Red Cross does not have to be requested by a foreign deployment, but they can be deployed on line 13 pursuant to a plan or cooperative agreement. So in other words, it can work it out ahead of time. The second change is the definition of volunteer health practitioner, and that makes it clear that you don't have to be salaried in order to get the benefit. And the third change is to extend to out-state practitioners who come in to the state in an emergency the tort protection that public employees have. And the two departments of state government that might be concerned are both, I won't say supportive, but because they haven't told me that, but they told me that they don't have any objections to the bill.
All right. Thank you. Representative Brock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Keeson, I just had a question related to the last section, I think, which is a good idea, the tort protections. But it talks about licensed practitioners who have been suspended, revoked, or have a limiting order. Those folks are not able to get protection, but they're able to practice. They can come in as a volunteer. They just don't have the protections. Am I understanding that correct? No?
Mr. Davies.
Madam Chair, they're not supposed to come in. They're not allowed to come in. If they do come in and don't tell people that they've been suspended, they don't get the protection. But they're not supposed to. It would be an unauthorized practice if they did come in.
Okay. Other questions, members? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Peterson, do you want to, anything you want to say more on the bill? Okay, Representative Peterson renews his motion that House File 521 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The bill is passed. Thank you. Next bill, Representative Peterson, House File 384. Representative Peterson moves that House File 384 be recommended to pass, referred to the Committee on Finance. And there is a DE1 amendment. And Representative Peterson, do you want to move your amendment?
I'll move the amendment.
All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we have testifiers on this, too, so I think we'll get to them quickly so we can move this ahead. Basically, what this is doing, Representative Emmer and I actually went out to Utah about, a year and a half ago now, or 2.5 years ago, to look at a system they had set up. We've been moving forward, members, on trying to get uniformity and standardization into the way we do our billing and eligibility determinations. We passed legislation on how we code those things in recent years. This kind of takes it a next step to move in the direction of a technology that will streamline how those payments and eligibility pieces are processed. The state of Utah has created a clearinghouse that some of these things, that this information can move through to make it more efficient and effective for everybody. This doesn't necessarily say we're going to do that, but it requires a group that already exists to take a look at, to have the charge of taking a look at that and figuring out how we best can establish this single standardized system for all purchases of healthcare transactions to process those as efficiently as possible. I'd just like to have the testifier explain the bill in a little more detail.
Sure. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the
record. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Phil Rivenis. I'm an active member of the Minnesota Medical Group Management Association, 800 members across the state running clinics, large and small. We've identified early this year 20 ways that we suggest to improve quality and save costs, and this is one of them. It's a very important one. It's estimated nationally that just the cost of reprocessing claims that have been rejected because some of the demographic information is incorrect would save $1.2 billion a year nationally. And none of that money goes to improving anybody's care, helping to keep the lights on for providers or payers. And so we think that this offers a real opportunity, and it's very patient-friendly as well. It's very important to know when you're applying for services, calling on the phone, or presenting, that your services are covered, or to know what your personal responsibility portion is. So we think that this is going to be beneficial for patients. We think that it's going to be extremely important for providers as we go through a series of very difficult times economically, and so we would appreciate your support. I have a couple of people here who will just add some additional technical information.
Okay, let me ask if there are any questions at this point from members. I don't see any, so please go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, good afternoon. My name is Ann Peterson, and I work for University of Minnesota Physicians as Vice President of Patient and Business Services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am here to ask for your support of House File 384. In my role at University of Minnesota Physicians, I am responsible for the entire revenue cycle for over 700 physicians. The success of our revenue cycle is heavily dependent upon electronic transactions, including those referenced in House File 384. I also serve on the steering committee for the Administrative Uniformity Committee, which is referenced in this proposed legislation. Today, we as a large group practice utilize at least two trading partners to try and obtain electronic eligibility data. We currently pay for each one of those transactions, and the costs continue to grow. We perform thousands of transactions per month and still experience denials related to inaccurate insurance information at a rate of 1.9% or 2,661 denials per month. This results in significant staff time to rework claims as well as delays in our, it causes delays in our revenue cycle. Additionally, for those payers in which our trading partners are unable to establish a connection, my staff have to log on to different websites using different passwords to locate the necessary data. The University of Minnesota Physicians is fortunate to have the resources to be able to perform such a large volume of electronic transactions. Smaller group practices do not have the same resources and have much more significant challenges accessing the same data. Whereas we have come a long way in the availability of data electronically in Minnesota, we still have an opportunity to take further steps to standardize the way payers and providers in the state of Minnesota access and share data electronically. The feasibility study proposed in this legislation will enable us to identify potential solutions that could result in substantial savings in healthcare administrative costs for providers. These savings would come in the areas of reduced denials as well as reduced costs for electronic transactions. Additionally, the potential solutions would enable ease of access to data for all providers, regardless of size. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today.
All right, thank you very much. Let's go to the next testifier, and then if there are questions at the end, we'll take them. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm Sandy Rutherford, and I am also a member of the Administrative Uniformity Committee. I'm on the Operations Committee, as well as the claim work group that is working with the best practices that will come into effect in July of this year for our healthcare providers. I am COO of Kaleidoscope Health Systems, and we provide an outsourced billing solution to smaller group practices in Minnesota. We are very familiar with their operational issues that they face, both in the metro and rural areas of the state. These providers have lived in a paper world, and they may or may not have started the journey into the electronic world despite the deadlines that are looming in July and December of this year. They have limited resources of staff, time, and money, and there's so much information out there that it becomes difficult for these groups to even know how to filter this information. They don't have a dedicated staff member or resource to really determine what is mission critical. And in the past, they often received information by paper means, where now you have to go out and oftentimes look for it. So this is a real barrier for these groups. Proper eligibility and coverage verification is imperative for them as well as for large systems. And the revenue cycle really begins with enrollment and at the time the patient makes the appointment. As Anna talked about, the current system requires a separate logon and password for each payer. And also, you oftentimes have to set up an administrator, so if a team member leaves, you may have trouble getting the information, having to change and update passwords. So for the smaller provider, this is very difficult and is something that with everything else coming in the future, they should be focusing on these mission-critical issues of claims and reimbursement. So the feasibility study is essential to continue to identify issues and resolutions that will benefit not only our providers but the consumers that they serve. And it's on behalf of these groups that we should support HS 384. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for members? Okay. I don't see any. Representative Thiessen, any closing comments?
Well, I do. I'd like to make one more amendment, if I could.
Okay.
It's on page 2.1. Line 2.1, to change 2010 to 2011.
Okay, Representative Thiessen moves an oral amendment on line 2.1 to change 2010 to 2011. Does everybody have that? Any discussion to that? All right, all in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, the amendment is adopted.
And then I'd actually like to amend the motion, then, Madam Chair. I understand we had a zero fiscal notice by doing that, so I'd like to move this to the floor instead of the Committee on Finance.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, then the motion then before the committee is...
And we will be getting a fiscal note that actually says that. So if it comes out bigger, I'll send it back to finance. But that's my.
Okay.
We will have actual things.
All right.
Vote.
Well, Representative Thiessen moves that House File 384 be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor as amended. Pardon me. House File 384 as amendment. As amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All those in favor?
General Rudd.
Oh.
Yeah.
Gosh, I don't
we know
what you're
saying.
She's a general register. Okay. Training continues. Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay. The bill is passed and sent to the general register.
Thank you.
Okay, welcome to the committee, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill will make the world a better place. So
okay.
I'd like to move House File 1233 be recommended to pass and move on to finance and then on to health finance.
Okay, Representative Abler moves that House File 1233 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. And Representative Abler, you have an author's amendment.
I do, and I have an oral amendment to that. And I guess we'll get the bill in order, then I'll talk about it. And on the... let's adopt the amendment. I'll just move the A1 amendment, which is... it could have been a delete all, but that would have been too easy. In fact, the amendment is longer than the base bill, so... but I'll move the A1 amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Abler moves the A1 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Right, your memory stopped.
Two I's and no A's that have passed. And then, Madam Chair, I need to amend the date. We're doing that a lot all of a sudden. On line 1.7 on the amendment and 1.10 on the base bill, if we could make that strike July 1, 2009 and insert January 1, 2010 in both cases. And I would move that amendment.
All right. Representative Abler moves an oral amendment on line, first on line 1.10 of the bill to amend 2009 to 2010. And then on line 1.7 of the amendment to change July 1st, 2009 to January 1st, 2010. Do I have that right, Representative Abler? All right. All those in favor of the amendment, or unless there's any question about that, okay? All in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. All right. The oral amendment is adopted.
I'm kind of glad the amendment was way more proper than the first amendment, so I'm glad you got the support of there. Madam Chair, members, the point of this bill is to create a statewide waiting list on all the waivers. The original bill was just a DD waiver, but I've been involved with this topic for quite some time. And the counties all have their ranking system. And as we talk about finding ways to make sure the people with the greatest amount of needs get served, right now the department doesn't have the capacity to do that generally. And so this would, the department says they can do it, at least they're neutral, it's not their bill, but they're here to talk about that. But the point of this bill is to create a statewide waiting list so when one spot opens up, we'll know who should get it. That's basically the point of the bill. There's concerns about if a facility closes, the ICFMR, what happens to them. That's one of the improvements. The department called up and they said, well, it's a nice idea, but we'll tell you how to make it work because what you want to do won't work. And that's why it took twice the length of the amendment to my simple idea about that. And so that's pretty much the bill. I do have a witness from the department who can identify herself and chat about it. That's the only witness I have. And then I'll stand for questions.
All right. Thank you, Representative Abler. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. Currently, what happens is that the counties maintain a waiting list for the DD waiver, and we don't believe that there's currently a waiting list for the CADI and TBI waivers, but there could be as allocations decrease. And the counties are responsible to manage a aggregate pool of resources and also manage a specific amount of allocations that we provide to them, based on the number of people that they identify waiting for services and how they are using their existing resources. Counties are required to have policies and procedures in place that identify how they will prioritize their resources, and so there are different ways that the 87 counties identify that how they'll do that, but they must abide by the current priorities that the department has identified, and those are priorities must be given to people who have a loss of caregiver and have emergency situations where they're losing their support system. And when there's a closure of an ICFMR, which Representative Abler mentioned, and also to prevent out-of-home placement for children. So those are the three priorities that are consistent across the state, but the way that the need is determined from county to county is different. And so what this bill would do would require the department to identify how we will determine who has the highest level of need and who would be next in line to receive the allocation.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Hamilton thought that there would not be cost involved in this, but I'm very happy to go to finance and we'll actually prove that. Even if there is some minor cost, which I hope is on the minor side, I hope this is something we can do. I think it'll help us manage these very important programs. And that's my thought to answer question.
Okay. Any Representative Norton?
My name's the same, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure I'm clear about this. Is the state then going to reallocate county funds based on someone with a higher need in a different county, or are you just going to decide within the county which person is next on the list? I was maybe not understanding that.
I can. Go ahead. Ms. Hamilton answer.
The intent of the language is to have the state, across the state, identify who would be next in line.
Ms. Norton.
So, well, I'm, this is going to be quite a change in how funds are allocated then. So this is, I mean, originally I was thinking this was a small bill. This could be, I mean, do we know if the counties have any concern about giving up their authority and getting a pot of money to give to people within the county?
Mr. Chair.
President Abler.
This only sets up a list. It doesn't make anything change, as I understand it. This would, the currently, if a slot opens up in Hennepin County, there could be a person with a grievous need in Kennebec County. And we don't even know they're there. Especially in a time where we're choosing our resources wisely, I think that we would agree that that we'd want to make sure the person with the greatest need in Minnesota got looked after. And that's the point of this. As we chatted in our private meetings with the different departments when they came in, Mr. Coleman and Alex, were there, and it occurred to me as we chatted, if they would visit every county, they would ask some of the counties, some of the people, how'd you get in a waiver? Because of the varying of how they're allocated, and so some counties appear to be full, but actually they're not full compared to, they're over full compared to some people who are underserved in other counties. And this is a way to help get the list. And at some point later, they'll be deciding how to spend the money. That's to be a different bill and a different time, but this way they'd know. And there's no provision to kick anybody out or anything, but this is just a way to get a list.
Representative Norton?
Well, making a list if you're not going to do something with it, and I was hearing that we would make a determination of severity. And so if we're not going to change how people spend the money, then I guess I'm a little confused. Oh, yeah. And I'm not opposed to doing what you're suggesting. I just am noting that that's a pretty significant change in the system if we're going to allocate funds based on need. So,
Mr. Chair, I said it wrong. This is for future people going on to a spot. So that next allocation would be the greatest need. I'm sorry. I said it wrong.
Okay, so...
My bill, I just said it wrong.
Representative Norton.
So if I'm understanding this will be changing the way we in the future, we will no longer give money to counties per se. It will be based on the amount of money the state has to divvy out to people that qualify based on need statewide. Am I correct in that? Maybe?
Not exactly. We would still expect to give county an out. The problem is that when we talk about allocation, there's two types of allocation. There's the funding, which the counties have an aggregate pool to manage. And then when we talk about a waiver allocation or a waiver slot, then that's an individual person, a new person. And so what we read this language as the state would manage those allocations, but the county would continue to manage their aggregate pool of resources.
I'm going to have to explain that more.
I'll say it a different way if you'd like. The counties currently get, A, B, C, D. There's different levels of severity, and they get a certain amount of money for the severity of the case, and it's a certain flat amount of money per month. Hopefully some person has more needs and somebody has less needs, and they can manage within their pot of however many millions of dollars the cases that they have to manage. And so when money opens up to create another average slot, they would look to see what county, where the next neediest person is. The county would get that allocation of money added to their allocation and the permission to add one more person to that person.
So they're going to be a maintenance of effort kind of thing where the counties are now are going to get the same pool of money they have now, and then as additional dollars are added, they would then allocate it in a different way?
No county would get any of that money.
The county would not receive less money. They would continue to receive the amount that they would normally receive for that individual.
Money follows.
So counties aren't allocated. I thought that you could manage the number of weight. You could have more people. A county could say, we're going to have 20 people because we're going to give them this amount, or we're going to have 30 people, but we're going to give lesser amounts to people. But this would change that because now the next dollar added in would actually go to a particular individual instead of a particular county.
I don't believe that that's what the language says. I believe
is my first part right? That now we allocate money to counties, not to individuals.
Correct.
Okay. So we have a pool of money that counties have. And then we say here, when a slot in the DD waivered service becomes available, and maybe I missed the amendment, the slot must be assigned to the individual on a statewide basis with the highest assessed needs.
Right.
So then they're not managing within this pool of money anymore. That county is getting one more slot. So in the past, what would happen if you got an additional amount of money, like for 10 more people, that would be allocated, what, per capita across the county? According to the formula?
The county would still, they still receive funding for an individual right now. They receive funding for an individual, but that funding they receive for the individual, they don't need to spend on that individual. They can spend more or less. That money goes into the aggregate pool, and they continue to meet everybody's needs.
Well, did they use the formula?
Okay, so what happens when we put more money in, so we take the cap off the waiting list, say, and all these people come in? But we raise the cap on the waiting list, so another 100 people come in. What would work under current law? How would that work?
Currently, if we have 100 new allocations, then those would be funded allocations. 100 people would come on with funding, but that money that comes into the pool doesn't necessarily need to be for their services. The counties can also add people more than that 100 if they are able to meet their needs within their current aggregate pool.
So someone's on the waiting list, 100 people come off the waiting list, whatever county they go into, that county gets the money.
Mm-hmm.
And what this would do is to say, instead of, if we were to open, you'd finish off the waiting list, but then that next person would go according to the highest assessed need, or would we switch who's on the waiting list?
I believe it would switch the order of the people on the waiting list.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, let me give
you
an example.
Now it's making sense.
And for the, we sat through this, I don't know what year it was, but I just remember one woman when we unlocked the waiting list the year, and she was like 70 or something, and her son was 50. And she said, and she had been raising this needy son her whole life. And she said, I don't really mind having given my life to raise my son, but who will watch him when I die? And that's the kind of needs that are there, and so who will watch this person? And that's the challenge, and so that's the point of it. So I think we've covered it pretty well. Any more questions?
Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Abler, I'm glad you're tackling this. I think it's a really important issue, and I think it does have some potential maybe to, you know, make sure that we're taking care of the most pressing needs. But my question is, how are we going to notify people, or are we? Are we going to tell the people on the currently on the waiting list where they fall now under this new ranking, and how is that all going to be handled? Because I think, I mean, I don't know, right now, do people have an expectation? Do they say, well, I'm number 10 on the list, or do they not have any idea where they are on the list?
I'm going to phone a friend, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, right now people don't have an idea of where they are on the waiting list. What happens when an individual is screened is they may indicate how soon they feel they need the waiver, and the county can determine whether they meet any of the priority criteria and then determine whether they can serve them on the waiting list. I think I would not want to notify people that they're number 10 on the list, because if emergency situations come up that might bump other people higher up on the list, we wouldn't want to have people have misinformation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good. You know, that's fine. But how are we going to notify people if this gets adopted? How are they going to know about the change? I mean, I think people who've been on the list 10 years are going to know if somebody maybe gets on there after a year. So I think people are going to be aware that there's a change. And I just wonder, how are we going to explain and prepare them for what the change is here?
No, that would be practical. Mr. Chair, I know in the past the Department of Treasury announces little bulletins with changes in how they're going to do it. And if the counties haven't told people they're fourth or ninth anyway, then just because you're on the list 10 years doesn't mean you have the greatest need to be on it. And if somebody shows up with a very egregious need, and some of these needs that are on the waiting list are profound. any reason the person would say this person is the one we should serve, and that's kind of the idea. And it may not be in your county, it might be in Kennebec County here.
Right. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, so do people already understand that that's the way, you know, that somebody with greater need may be ahead of them? I mean, if people already have that understanding right now, so we're not really changing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, yes. Right now, people they understand that they're waiting based on their need, and that they may be waiting for several years, and somebody else may be waiting for a few months, but that they have a higher need.
Representative Gallo. Okay. Representative Locke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Abler. It feels to me like we're trying to take a state and create a state system, but we keep all the responsibility at the local level. And I don't know that that's fair either to the people on the waiting list or to the people who are providing services, in that I think the county, first of all, managed within a budget and have promoted the use of cost-effective services as a result in order to serve the maximum number of people within the budget constraints that they have. But when an opening happens, and my expectation is that when an opening happens in a very high need facility that can handle someone who really has high needs, that's the person that the county most, you know, I mean, we all respond, all counties across the state respond to emergencies. You know, the caretaker has a health problem, whatever, everyone does their best to respond to emergencies. But then it's also balancing your service system. And there's county dollars at risk here on who serves and who isn't, because the counties are contributing to semi-independent living services and other things as well. And so if you happen to have in your county a slot that opens in a particular service provider, you may look to the list to move someone in who can fit that need, so that you're maximally using your services that are the mix, current mix within your community. And I think I haven't heard that system has discriminated against people who have high needs, and I haven't heard that there's a problem with people managing it in terms of what's available, what's an appropriate service slot that is open, not a DD waiver slot, but a service slot within a day training program, within a residential setting program, whatever, and keeping that flexibility at the local level where they actually know what the capabilities of a service provider are. I think makes a lot of sense. The only reason to go to a state list is to have a central list. You could say this person is number 397, as far as I can tell, or if there seems to be a problem in thinking that counties aren't responding to those emergency needs as when they need to. But maybe I'm just not understanding the problem that this is trying to correct enough. But I do think it creates problems at the implementation level, and keeping those service providers having the kind of population that will keep their cost per person served, you know, at a reasonable basis and fill, you know, vacancies at all levels of the service spectrum.
Well, that's a good question. I think that's one of the benefits of having a moving bill, and then he can chat with you about the details. But I do want to point out, I hear listening to the discussion. I mean, there's 5,000, 8,000 people on the waiting list. We don't know what they look like and what they need. And I think even in this way, if we were going to, like, put $4 million more into this, let's just say we need to open up, you know, what's that going to buy? And maybe there's a group of people that are just really bad needs, and then the bell curve drops off, and there's a kind of a natural break. And so you serve the next 1,000, and the next 9,000 really aren't so poorly off, and we feel comfortable that we've solve the greatest need. There's no mechanism to do that yet. And I'm really happy to work with you on making sure that we, you know, don't cause harm to providers. But I still, at the other side, this is about the people and about the patients. And there's a way to balance keeping providers serving, because you can't shut them down by taking away half their people because slots would change. But at the same side, we have to serve the people, especially as times lean up and we have limited resources to do the greatest good. So that's the intention. And any details that we can work on between now and finance, and when the thing ever leaves, if this can advance, it could be April sometime, I suppose. That would be a great.
Representative Bunn.
Mr. Chair, I'm just and to Representative Ayler, I'm very uncomfortable with this without hearing from the counties. I mean, for the reasons that have been discussed by Representative Lafa and others, it's just that I have, there was a comment made on a testifier that he didn't think there was waiting list for caddy waivers. I have people who have been waiting for a caddy forever. They've been told unless they put their kid in a nursing home, they'll never get one. So just tough it out, or they'll send them across, you know, to another part of the state and put them in an institution. I mean, so, you know, there's, it's really tough stuff out there. And I think the movement in terms of what you're talking about makes total sense to me in terms of rationalizing and, you know, and with very limited resources, doing the most severe cases first. But if this is a very significant break from what we're doing currently, which to me it sounds like it is, I would have thought we'd have the counties here commenting on this. So I'm...
Well, they're here.
Oh, okay.
They're not here. They're in bottom. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, Patricia Caldwell, Association of Minnesota Counties. I have to confess that we have not had an opportunity to talk to Representative Abler or the department about this bill yet, and I think we do really recognize the sense, the intent of having some kind of a map of what are the priorities statewide so that we can use the resources more effectively, and it probably ties in also with some of the proposals that the department has initiated really at CMS's directive to have more consistency in how rates are set and how level of need is determined across the state. So I think that intent really makes a lot of sense. However, Representative Loeffler's point about having the flexibility to manage the service delivery system based on the resources that are available in the community is something that we would be really concerned about losing. So we would like the opportunity to work with Representative Abler and the department on just talking through what some of the implications might be on this as it moves forward. I think the amendment about talking about assessed needs and other priorities makes a lot of sense. Counties would want to be involved in determining what those other priorities are, and I guess kind of how fluid that list might be, because they're really balancing the need for some predictability with also the need to have some flexibility at the local level as the, you know, as the environment changes and as the clients' needs change. So that's kind of where we are at this point.
Mr. Chair, do we have any information on what's the path to this bill and whether it's going to have any fiscal note, either positive or negative or neutral?
It's going to finance, and I think Representative Abel indicated we don't know if what the fiscal impact is going to have, but it won't be large. If there is,
that's what, and Mr. Chair, that, you know, I'm very happy to talk. I'm friendly to the counties, for heaven's sakes. That's one of my trademarks. And so we can work on language that makes sure that they have soft land providers, and also if the committee decides they want this list to move along, we can make it functional.
President Norton?
Just one more thought, and maybe I'm off base in this, but if we go to a statewide system to allocate the funds in this particular way, I think it's an interesting concept, and I think it needs a little bit more work, and it sounds like you're willing to do that. I would worry a little bit about, kind of tied to Representative Loeffler's comments, about are there certain areas of the state or communities that where individuals live that might be less likely to be deemed caddy waiver or because of the opportunity within the community. What I would hate to see, my bottom line is, I would hate to see money all end up in one place or two places and not have it distributed throughout the state so people that live in multiple communities are able to get the help, because communities are different, the assets and liabilities they have are different, and, you know, a paper or a state looking at a piece of paper may not be able to take that into effect in a way that would be appropriate. So I just throw that in the mix for the discussion that moves forward on this.
And just to kind of follow what I was thinking about at the beginning here, kind of on that. So say 10 slots open up and a county gets 3 allocations according to this list, but they manage their money so that they can actually serve 4 people. Does that fourth person have to come off the list, or is that's the connection between the state and the county piece that I don't. And maybe that's what everybody is raising here, but
I think we'll have to figure that out.
And I think it's really, I think there's 2 things you're trying to do. One is to get this list to kind of get the information, which I think is good. And then there's a second sentence that says they're going to be assigned according to that. And it seems like that's for the. I think it sounds like everybody's okay with kind of developing a list.
Mr. Chair, I kind of see that allocation language softening a little bit.
Okay. So, any other questions?
And there's a technical amendment. One of the dates was wrong.
Should be 20 on line 1.10. It should be January 1st, 2010.
Right.
So if all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? That prevails. And thank you. I also want to thank you, Representative Abler, for working on this, because I think it is a worthy pursuit. And so, any other discussion? Seeing none, all those in Representative Abler removes his motion that House File 1233 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, members.
All right, Representative Lane. Representative Lane moves that House File 1012 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a delete all amendment that's a technical amendment to correct the language in the bill to make it financially accurate.
Okay.
You have that before you?
Representative Lane, we do. It's the A09-0100 amendment. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
And I would just want to add a comment in here on the wording. We usually use reserves as the common term we use in discussing the health plans have at the end of the day, but it's not the proper term. The proper term is actually surplus. It's officially the statutory capital and surplus that the health plans keep. So I will probably be using the word surplus a little more often here. First, a little background. We created the health plans as nonprofit entities and initially required them to maintain a surplus with a minimum amount for solvency and a maximum cap on that surplus because they didn't need to be endlessly accumulating surplus as a nonprofit with a public purpose. Their previous year's expenditures were used to establish a 1 to 3 month corridor or a 2 to 4 month corridor. Blue Cross Blue Shield has a 2 to 4 month corridor. Not less than 1 or 2 months for solvency, not more than 3 or 4 months as a cap. But in 2004, we changed to the national industry standard for insurers called risk-based capital. This is a much more sophisticated calculation than the crude or arbitrary month method. I'll explain more on that in a minute, and I have Tom Pender here from House Research also to answer questions. But the other thing that happened in 2004 is that the cap on the surplus was removed. Some tell me that was because the tobacco settlement fund blew the cap off one of the health plans, but others say it's just because risk-based capital is mostly used for assessing financial strength of a company. Whatever the reason, the health plans may now accumulate more and more, and they have been doing so. In my opinion, and I have 35 co-authors, that this accumulation needs some regulatory control. In a time when premiums are rising and benefits decreasing, the health plans do not, in my opinion, need to be increasing their surplus far above the levels that indicate healthy financial strength. We cleaned up another piece of this regulatory control in last year's health bill when we told the health plans that if you're going to count expenses of investing your surplus, then you also must count the income that you gain from the investments, and they weren't doing that. The expenses were involved were counted, but not the income. I think it's important that this committee understand a bit more about what risk-based capital calculation involves, so you can see why the cap set in this bill is somewhat generous. The formula used calculates the risk involved, so it's not an arbitrary reference just to the history of last year's expenses. It measures four main categories of risk that include changes in the market, default risk on what they're owed, underwriting and price risk of underestimating that, and general business risk. There are specific formulas for health insurers, life insurers, property and casualty insurers, so it's a very targeted formula. The formulas are reviewed annually for refinement, improvement, and updating for new risks. Health plans with a single product like Delta Dental have much less risk than a major health insurer. A month, if we were using that old method, of last year's expenses would be a high level of financial strength for Delta Dental, but a low level of financial strength for Blue Cross Blue Shield. However, the risk-based capital calculation for each of these lets us make an apple-to-apple comparison of the financial strength for each. So So 100% of risk-based capital is the capital needed bottom line for the risk calculated for a company. But 200% risk-based capital, twice that amount of capital, is considered to be the minimum amount a company should have on hand. So they can go to 300%, 400%, even 500% of the amount of capital held in surplus, having been calculated via this formula that in itself considers the riskiness of the business or the times or the expected challenges, but that's enough. So, and I would like to emphasize that the formula considers the risk, even times of recession. It's not just simply an amount of capital. It's a formula that takes risk, such as the current business risk, into calculation and sets the, so a 500% at one time would be a different amount of capital than 500% at a more risky time. So the 500% changes according to the risk that their business involves. It isn't a set amount. And every year it's recalculated. So to claim that you need more capital on hand for ups and downs, well, the calculation itself sets that in the amount of money that's set aside. So let's be sure that premiums are lowered rather than surpluses increased. That's my bottom line here. And besides Tom Pender, I also have Ellen Baumgarten here also with me. You have his biographical notes before you. He's an independent research consultant who publishes the Minnesota Health Market Review and does so for also 8 other states. He worked in the 80s for the legislative auditor, and he continues to offer a clear analysis of the healthcare market and healthcare issues. So any questions about risk-based capital and the financial state of the health plans can be answered by these two. And I just want to throw another note in here that the Chamber of Commerce has told me that they're going to be neutral on this. With that, I would take questions.
Any questions for the author? Ms. Nagao.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wayne, I actually have a lot of questions, and I'm sure others will as well, hopefully, here. It's a little surprising in light of the losses that HMOs have experienced recently that we'd have a bill like this coming forward. I can understand the concern about a large health plan carrying around a lot of money and maybe reimbursing their executives instead of reducing premiums, but some of the things you're proposing here would put, frankly, a lot of people who have coverage at greater risk. We just received some information here. I knew this in general, but didn't know the total amount. Our HMOs in the state had their worst financial year ever in 87. They lost $22.8 million in revenues on revenues of more than $1 billion. The reason that we allow for those things is to provide stability and protection for the people that are covered under HMOs in this state. And that's mainly to protect against negative selection. And you suddenly get a large amount of claims, and you're talking about jeopardizing the coverage of a lot of people in the state of Minnesota. So I'd like to figure out a little bit more where your numbers are coming from and what prompted you to go this route.
Representative Lane or Mr. Baumgarten?
Mr. Baumgarten, please
introduce yourself. Mr. Chairman, members, Alan Baumgarten. I reside in St. Louis Park. I'm an independent analyst on healthcare markets and competition. I published an annual report called Minnesota Health Market Review. I've published that since 1990. And in that report, I use the data that's part of the annual statements that are filed by each of the HMOs and other insurers to calculate a number of metrics of their financial performance and enrollment trends and market share and so on. The most recent data that's available, as you cited, is from 2007. The 2008 data does not become available until it's filed on April 1. The results that I reported in my 2008 report show that for 2007, the 8 or 9 licensed HMOs in the state had net operating income of $25.7 million, and in addition to that, they had investment income of about $92.3 million. So their total margin for the year of 2007 was about $119 million, or a margin of about 2.3% of their underwriting revenues. As a general statement, I would say that the financial standing or the financial condition of the HMOs and other health insurers in the state, while it's varied over the years, is generally quite strong, and I think that's represented by the data that's available on how they comply with the risk-based capital requirements. The average ratio that's calculated, as explained by Representative Lane, for the HMOs was 538% in 2003, and it's increased relatively steadily in the last 5 years, so that at the end of 2007, the average for the HMO companies was 657%.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, and the problem with having strong reserves is what? Again, I I'm asking this seriously because I believe, if I understand Representative Lane's bill correctly, it is adjusting this in almost real time when, in fact, you have to protect yourself against catastrophic claims going forward. So these claims come in, you have a tough year, and this will be a question, maybe a second question for Representative Lane, Mr. Chair. How you compensate for that in real time, given the time frame of your bill and how it adjusts the margin that they can carry forward. But my point is, why wouldn't we want to have strong health plans with reserves to protect against that kind of thing so that we don't have the situation where people either become disenrolled, they have to move to a different health plan. Again, looking at the historical data, it is very possible that these people can lose a large amount of money very quickly and put the enrollees at risk if they don't have strong reserves.
This is exactly what risk-based capital is for, as a national, in fact, international standard, to calculate for that risk. So that we're not, like I say, we're not talking about a set money that now doubling time comes and they're not allowed to go above that. The amount in the risk-based capital calculation itself calculates in the risk, and the number itself could actually be a higher amount of capital during a time of risk.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, you're talking about calculating in a level of risk after the risk has already occurred. I mean, the problem here is that you're not adjusting that in real time. Okay? So they experience a significant amount of claims, catastrophic claims, that impact them significantly, and now suddenly the risk is identified and adjusted going forward. That's too late.
Mr. Chair, that's why it's 500% of risk-based capital. There's plenty of room.
Does when the Commerce Department sets rates each year, do they build in so they, you know, because they said they do we do does the Commerce Department address premiums for the health plans in some context? And if they do they build in the reserve amount? Or am I totally off base here?
Yeah, we're wondering about.
You guys can talk about that. We'll go to another question. So, Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Commerce is here, so we the experts. I just had a question specific to the bill. I know you want to get to testifiers.
No, fine.
Representative Lane, what I'm trying to understand is how this Section 68.50 Subdivision 4 works to actually accomplish what you're mentioning that you want to accomplish with the bill. The way I read Subdivision 4, it just says that the commissioner shall define an action, but they don't define what it is. So, a corrective action. So, how does this bill actually reduce premiums?
The Commissioner of Commerce would be responsible for this, and the Commissioner of Commerce has an obligation to the state and to the taxpayer, and so as they set a corrective action, it would be a corrective action that would benefit the monies that we have put into these programs, for instance, through the public programs, that we would get some of that back. In fact, that was some of the thoughts of Senator Berglund last year when she attempted to do some of this.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lane, but it doesn't say that. And so it says a corrective action. And so the commissioner could determine that the best corrective action would be making sure that it's solvent or making sure that the reserves actually are of a substantial amount to ensure that the premiums aren't increased if insolvency occurs. So it doesn't actually accomplish, if I'm reading it properly, and that's what I'm asking, it doesn't actually say or do what I think you're wanting to do, Mr. Chair.
The corrective action would only come about should the health plans go over their 500% risk-based capital. It's not that they would then seek to keep them solvent, because that would be a high level of solvency or financial strength already. If they go over that, the corrective action is to then return back to those who have paid into that and had their money gone into this surplus, receive that back, either by, as we did one time, I believe we had Medica do a refund to, or at least was do a refund of premium to people who had paid the premium. Another thing would be to have them reduce the premiums over the next year so that they could have that the people receive that back, or do a public health campaign of some sort that then gives it back to the people in some way. But this was purposely left open because we didn't want to dictate what would be done according to the situation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And now I'm even more concerned that now we're going to take money out of something that isn't the state, transfer it to the state, and then use it for a public health campaign, which we don't know.
No, we would ask the health plans would need to would lower their surplus by doing a corrective action. The health plans would do the corrective action to reduce their premiums by doing something that would be a public benefit. It would be in discussion with the commissioner to work this out of what they would do to then give back what they unnecessarily took.
Interesting.
Representative Blossom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Lane, or maybe Mr. Baumgartner. Just trying to understand, if you have excess reserves that are five times what our formulas say are your risk rate. So, I mean, it would have to be five times anything what someone expects to have happen, as I understand risk-based capital. And you can never totally predict the future. One of the advantages that I'm, as I'm thinking it through, would be that when you get the reserves too high, the health plan becomes too dependent upon interest earnings, and all of a sudden you're at risk of massive market fluctuations in cost, premium cost, and you think of how much interest earnings have dramatically changed in the last few months, and that puts all customers who are paying premium at risk if you have too high a reserve. And so I think this actually kind of tends to have a sort of reasonable margin around not getting too dependent upon interest earnings to keep premiums low, but relating it to the direct cost of services and to making sure that those premiums continue to be related mostly to the services that need to be funded. And so I actually think this may actually provide for more stability in the insurance market than we might otherwise have, because as we've learned in the last 6 months, you can't count on interest earnings as a stable source of revenue over a long period of time.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll have comments later, but just to correct some things that have been said, this applies to HMOs and health plans. That means that the commissioner involved is, if it's an HMO, it's the commissioner of health that's responsible for this. If it's a health plan, it's the commissioner of commerce that's responsible for corrective action. And I'll talk a little bit more later, but back in 1987, the corrective action was to force these companies to have larger reserves, and the only way they can have larger reserves is to raise their premiums.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, that was in what year?
87.
So that was before we were using risk-based capital.
Mr. Chair, that was before we were using risk-based capital, but the risk-based, where they are right now is within the limits that we had before we went to risk-based capital.
The corrective action there was because they were under the minimum?
Well, they were broke.
Right. Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, the risk-based capital prevents that.
This wouldn't change that, is what you're saying?
No, this would have nothing to do with that.
Okay. And let's go to the other testifier, which might bring us more information, and I don't even know who that is right now. So, someone, Julie, Ms. Bruner, sorry. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Julie Bruner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Health. The Council of Health Plans is the trade association for the 8 nonprofit HMOs in Minnesota. Plan representatives had an opportunity to talk with Representative Lane, I think yesterday, to get a better sense of what she was proposing in the legislation. And nevertheless, I'm here today to testify against the legislation. I do, however, want to really compliment Representative Lane for trying to learn about risk-based capital because it is really complicated. It's I spent some time myself a couple of years ago trying to understand it, and it's pretty complicated. Several years ago, as you heard, the legislature changed the method of determining the reserve levels held by the state health plans. Formerly, the plans were required to maintain between 1 and 3 months or 2 and 4 months for Blue Cross Blue Shield. And you heard, I think, a good description of the switch to risk-based capital. Every state in the nation has now adopted risk-based capital. No state in the nation has a cap on risk-based capital for health plans. In preparing for the hearing today, we did a little calculation, and the plans currently are holding between 2 and 3 months of health care claims in reserve or surplus. 500% RBC is just over 2 months. So bear in mind, 2 months is what we're talking about. The average amount held by plans is currently about $1,370 per enrollee. That's not quite enough to pay the cost of the average broken arm. And if you've had any medical care lately, you know that $1,370 in some circumstances doesn't go very far. The point I'm trying to make here is that the health plans in Minnesota are not holding excessive reserves right now. We are, in fact, continuing to hold reserves that have been the norm in Minnesota for a number of years. The purpose of reserves is to have adequate funds to pay health care claims and to be ready for the unexpected. Reserves permit the plans to continue serving members without disruption, even when a plan is dealing with an operating loss, which happens because of the cyclical nature of this industry. Dealing with government shutdowns, which has happened in the past, or dealing with the lengthy underwriting cycles, health plans typically have to project 18 to 24 months in advance when setting premiums. In this fast-changing healthcare environment, the need to have adequate levels of reserves is critical when you look that far into the future. The state itself has specifically identified in their pandemic influenza plan a role for the health plans to continue paying for medical care in the event of a pandemic event with minimal administrative requirements in order to ensure continuity in the payment and support of the delivery of needed medical care. The plans will be able to do this because they have financial reserves available. The recent financial bailouts of banks and insurance companies by government illustrates the important role reserves or surpluses play in the economic health of every industry. We are all acutely aware of the government bailouts of private companies that fail to ensure their financial solvency. To artificially cap reserves only serves to put the health plans at risk at a time when health care spending is high and going higher. Health plans use reserves to hold down the cost of premium increases. The plans use reserves to make up losses that they experience in government programs. This is a cyclical industry. The plans use reserves to make up losses for commercial products as well. The plans use reserves to invest in community assets like the Institute for Clinical System Improvement, Minnesota Community Measurement, the Minnesota Credentialing Collaborative, and many other community benefit expenditures. According to the Minnesota Department of Health's recent community benefit report, in 2007, the health plans invested $75 million in community benefits. It would seem that the plan should be applauded for maintaining a strong financial footing right now, and that artificially capping their reserves and putting them in financial risk and making it difficult for them to meet their obligations is unwise. This proposal seems counterintuitive to the current financial circumstances that businesses and individuals in the U.S. and worldwide are dealing with. I'm unaware of any other business in Minnesota where the legislature has acted to limit the amount of money an industry can hold in reserve. It wasn't too many years ago, and Representative Huntley alluded to it, that the state had to intervene to support financially troubled health plans. During the 1980s, the legislature enacted reserve requirements because the health plans went through formal insolvency proceedings and the entire industry was in extreme financial distress. State regulators were very concerned about the financial vulnerability of the industry, and the legislature responded to these problems. And that was in 1998, they enacted the 1 to 3 month corridor, which, if you recall, we continue to maintain reserves in the 1 to 3 month corridor under a risk-based capital calculation. The objective of the legislation was to stabilize the financial viability of the industry in order to protect enrollees' access to medical care given the past history. Given the extreme pressures of the healthcare spending today, it seems both ironic and especially unwise to go down a path of limiting reserves and exposing the health plans to potential financial problems. By artificially limiting reserves, this bill also has the potential to force rate increases when the plans experience losses that might have been in the past absorbed by reserves. I don't know where the 500% of risk-based capital came from. I don't know why it isn't set in 50. I don't know why it isn't 1,000. I think it's an arbitrary number. I think it is very risky to institute something like this right now, and we would ask the committee to reject this proposal.
One question that I had, or one observation, I think a lot of the issues that arise around this is because money gets dumped into different buckets all the time. For instance, you said in this report that we're using all this money for ICSI and the reserves for ICSI and this and that. In the report, you're saying those are coming out of your, you know, operating expenses. You know, so I think we start to use the same money counted in a lot of different buckets of things, and I think that causes some of the health plan perception problems at the legislature. I think more transparent, if you were to get together with folks and work on a lot more transparency around what to do, I think we'd I think that's where a lot of the frustration from the legislature is coming from, and you probably feel like you're incredibly transparent, but we don't feel like that in the legislature, and I think that's a significant issue here.
If I may, Mr. Chair, first of all, if I misspoke and said that the community benefit expenditures are coming out of operating expenses.
No, you said out of reserves. I think okay. The analysis in here was that they're really kind of things you spend money on. I don't know where reserves end and they don't end. You know, I imagine when you're calculating this number, which is your reserve, that's net of all those other types of expenditures that you've already made, right?
Yes.
It wouldn't make sense otherwise. Yes. Okay. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I have to say, going back a ways in your testimony where you talked about the reserves, and I think you said $1,300 per covered person, and it's about the cost of a broken arm, something like that. And I just want to say, I think that's an incredibly misleading way to put this, because the whole nature of insurance is that you're spreading risk. And what are the odds of every one of your covered people getting a broken arm at the same time? I mean, it's just ridiculous. So I think it's a just an utterly meaningless statement, and as I say, very misleading. One thing that I do want to point out here that we're kind of forgetting about is that, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but when the state negotiates rates with the health plans, isn't the state making up for losses or considering how the plan did the year before when they negotiate the next set of rates? So in a way, as I understand it, the state is kind of guaranteeing the financial viability of the plans in the setting of the rates. So there's some obligation on the state to set the rates in such a way that the plans don't lose out over the, so that the plans stay viable in that over a period of time. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but some of the statements that you made really don't take account of that. You're talking about needing these reserves to make up for losses on government programs. Well, I think we're doing this by that other mechanism. You said how many industries are guaranteed against, how many industries would we cap their reserves or something like that, that this would be the only industry that we'd be doing this for. Well, I don't think there are too many industries that have this kind of government guarantee against losses. I mean, we're seeing that an awful lot now in banking and so on. I'm not sure that's a good thing. But certainly we're doing that already, as I understand it, with our plans here in Minnesota. And if I'm wrong, please correct me. But I think that puts you in a very different category than just some other business. And I think that comparison is, again, a very misleading comparison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I didn't mean to be this misleading. I was trying to give examples and sort of context, and if it was inappropriate or I didn't mean it to be misleading, I was trying to give some context. I think when you're talking about the rates, you're talking about government programs. Okay, the health plan reserves are their whole books of business. So government programs are a small part of that. The Department of Human Services, as I understand it, and I want to speak for them, don't expect the health plans to run in the red on government programs. And what they do is they adjust the rates every year when they negotiate the contract to reflect what may have happened the year before. If the plans made money the year before, they're going to bring those rates down. If the plans lost money the year before, they'll try to adjust it. And they work on something called trend, and experts who understand this much better than me can explain it, but they take into account what the experience it was, what expenditures were, changes in the law, new eligibility, and so those are all things that go into negotiating rates. There's no expectation that the plan would operate in the red or completely break even in government programs. There's some margin that is anticipated in government programs. But these adjustments come probably 18 to 24 months later. So if we have a loss in 2006, the plan has to pay for that loss in a government program, and they would use their reserves. And the adjustment would come when they negotiated the contract in 2007 and probably in the 2008 rate. So I mean, there have to be reserves available. We have a limited period, 30 days or 60 days or whatever, to pay bills. So we can't wait until we readjust the rate with the state to pay the bill. Those monies in reserve are used to do that kind of thing.
Mr. Chair. Representative. Well, thank you for that answer. But, you know, nobody's expecting you to reduce your surplus to zero. I mean, nobody's suggesting that here at all. So,
I didn't hear you say that either.
And I kind of, well, but, you know, we recognize that you might, you know, there might be this little time, a little time delay, as you were talking about, but When was the last year that the rate for public programs went down?
Ms. Burr.
Madam Chair, and Representative Liebing, I think you'd have to get that kind of information from the Department of Human Services. I don't have that information with me.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brunner, can you tell me what section of the Internal Revenue Code that your groups are incorporated, 501c something?
C4? Both.
Okay.
501c3 and
501c. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rosengard.
Mr. Brunner, the reason I work for 501c3 is, you know, in your garden variety charitable organizations for 15 years, and our rule of thumb was you want to build up a 6-month reserve for dealing with whatever happens. Now, those were set up differently than yours. You've got a totally different business model. So when I heard 2 months, that kind of shocked me that it was that small. Mm-hmm. So that answered my question. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
I would like to make some comments to the testimony that's been given here. And when she stated that it's difficult to understand the risk-based capital, yes. And I did spend a great deal of time speaking to the group in Missouri that created this, I believe, the NEIC, and with the Department of Commerce over here, and reading and understanding it myself. And I believe that the way that the testifier here has presented it is not accurate. And the other thing about the comment that no other state has capital, no other state has nonprofit health plans. And as she continued to talk in terms of months, I emphasize again, we are not dealing with months, we're dealing with the formula of risk-based capital, so the risk is involved in the formula to calculate that. It is not a consideration of, oh dear, we only have so many months to go by. The risk is based into that. And the cyclical process of these plans, that's a part of this. The risk-based capital for health plans is specifically targeted for health plans. And so all health plans across the entire nation would have this cyclical understanding, and their formula would include that in it. I would emphasize that in this day when we have a greater awareness of how industry sometimes needs regulation, especially if they're operating in a nonprofit way and for a public purpose, that we need to have oversight and regulation of that entity. And the worst example is what was the crisis we're in because of the lack of regulation. They negotiate their rates so that they get the amount of income that is applicable to the times that they're in. They do business very well. They also have other business lines besides the ones we're addressing, so there is revenue coming in. They are not going to go insolvent. They are very, very financially solvent, and I just would like to have Mr. Baumgartner talk a little bit more about that.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Baumgartner. Sorry.
Thank you. Just 2 points to respond. One, Ms. Bruner brought up the issue of losses on public programs. The historic record shows that public programs in Minnesota are the most profitable line of business for the HMO companies. Last year was a low year, and their underwriting profit on the public programs was only $25 million. In previous years, it's been more in the area of $60 to $80 million. The other comment I want to make goes to the point of Representative Huntley, I think. Going back to the history, back in the late 80s, and I was on the staff of the Legislative Auditor's Office then, two HMOs went insolvent, two small ones, and at that time the original HMO statute required only that an HMO have about $100,000 in the bank to go into business. And in 1987 and 1988, you had the two insolvencies, and you had the other large health plan companies like Medica and Health Partners and Blue Plus essentially skating on very thin reserves. And so the determination was made at the legislature at that time to increase and make more stringent the standards for reserves to address that problem. And it was phased in over 5 years to a minimum of 1 month of operations. A few years later, the cap of 3 months was added for the HMO companies. The experience has been that the HMO companies were building up their reserves so that by the mid-2000 decade, there were several of them that were close to 3 month limit. And in one case, and that was mentioned by one of the other members, Medica declared a payment holiday for the last installment in December as a way of bringing down the reserve so that they wouldn't bump into the three-month limit.
We have three people left on that might have a lot of questions, and we're going to finish up here because we're running out of time. So Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I just wanted to put on the record, it's not fact that the situation we're in is caused by lack of regulation. I would argue in some senses that the situation we're in is caused by some regulation and dysfunctional regulation that's out there, not just in healthcare, but in the mortgage market and across the board. And it sounded as though you stated it as fact, and I just wanted to put on the record that that's disputed. One of the questions I had is actually for the Department of Commerce. It would seem to me that the argument you make, Representative Lane, is that risk-based capital should take those needs into account so going forward. And so the argument that you make would suggest that reserves in general aren't needed. Is that your position? And I'm curious what the Department of Commerce would think about that, because if you're saying it's already included, that would be an argument for reserves not being necessary.
Ms. Chair,
Lane.
I am certainly not saying surplus is not necessary for solvency or for financial strength of the company, so I don't know what your...
It may have been me asking an ill-advised question along those lines.
Okay, Ms. Chairman. I just heard something, yeah. And I thought, well, that's an argument for the wrong direction. But the plans are saying that it's 2 to 4 months, so that's a pretty short period of time. I mean, Fannie Mae now is requiring 6 months. We states should have, we're requiring cities have reserves. 2 to 4 months doesn't seem like that much time. So I'm wondering if the Department of Commerce can talk about that 2 to 4 months, if that's standard. Is it outrageous? Is it low? What do they think about this?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Jackie Gardner. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Commerce. My major and primary and most important role in life is to make sure that all insurance companies are healthy. I need some water. I've been sitting back there just waiting. Excuse me, just a second. Okay. I'm wondering if before I answer any or address any specific questions, if maybe I should get some clarification going on. There's a lot of terminology that's been thrown around the table.
And we have like about 7 minutes left.
I will give you my 7 minute
response. Well, we have 7 minutes left for everything. So about 3 minutes, if we could.
3 minutes. The monthly reserve thing was a concept that probably started way back in the 80s when there was, you know, some need to measure how much money do you need to hold in order to operate over some kind of an operating cycle or accounting cycle, et cetera. It was a very crude measurement, but it was the only thing that they had at that time. Somewhere later in the regulatory process, the concept of risk-based capital became the forefront there. And the formula basically takes into account credit risk, operating risk, business risk, and liabilities for insurance risk. Insurance risk is very complicated, and I apologize for that, but that's just the way it is. It's a very complicated thing. The representative here tried to do her best to explain risk-based capital, but it is not an easy concept to explain. But as a solvency regulator, my main concern is safety and soundness of the entity as well as consumer protection. Reserves are not surplus. Reserves are liabilities. and liabilities are dollars that secure the contractual obligations of an insurance contract. So that's what a reserve is. Surplus is the difference between your assets and your liabilities. And liabilities are just one. Reserves are just one liability. It's not all of them. It's just one of the liabilities. So your surplus is basically a mathematical computation, assets minus liabilities, you got surplus. The more, the better. Safety and soundness depends on having that surplus there to ride out any kind of cyclical condition that insurance companies have. A nonprofit versus a for-profit entity, in my world, has nothing to do with solvency. You're still underwriting a risk. You still must have money in place in order to pay out benefits, expenses, etc., for those contractual obligations that you've taken on as an insurance entity. So the nonprofit feature doesn't really matter to me. It matters whether or not that entity can pay its obligations. And claims have to be paid when they become due, not at some time in the future when things get better or when you can make an assessment, but you have to pay these things now. Revenues come in over a contractual period of time, a 1 year, a quarter, or whatever, but those claims and those payments and those costs, they continue on and on and on. Risk is something that is an intangible concept. We don't know when it's going to happen. I have to use an example of, we had catastrophes like Katrina or 9/11, those things. Only a couple of companies failed because they had enough surplus to ride that out. You don't have an opportunity to say, only on 9/11 is something going to happen. It could happen at any time. There's no such thing as too much surplus. Surplus is there. It's necessary for a company to be able to operate because their operations go on regardless of whether or not their revenue stream changes or whatever. They still have a certain base of people that they'll have to serve. And I don't know today if I'm going to have a broken arm, or maybe tomorrow I'm going to have a heart valve replacement. Those things are unknown, but that revenue is already there. That's frozen. The company still has to pay for those costs and services and those benefits and those contractual obligations. And surplus is there to help make sure that those operations continue at the same level all the time that they need to be, to serve the consumer. And that's our main goal, consumer protection.
And what's the other check on that? The marketplace?
Me.
Okay.
That's what the regulator is for. The regulator regulates.
In terms of the surplus getting too large.
We don't have an excess surplus term that we use in solvency oversight.
And I'm asking the question from this perspective. One of the ways you start to build up these surpluses is by charging higher premiums to people. You know, so internally the companies are going to calculate that out, right? And then it depends on their claims and all their risk, all the underwriting kind of things as well. But at some point, a company, I don't know why they'd want to do it, but they could double their premiums, which would go right into reserves, right? But there's a marketplace check, presumably, on that as well.
Exactly. You mean, the market can only stand so much. I mean, if you charge too much, no one's going to buy your product. There is, you know, this is still a competitive market.
Mr. Chair?
So yes, Representative Lynch.
I would just like to say, and I appreciate the Department of Commerce and her role that she stated clearly, is to make sure that everybody that they have oversight over has solvency. Our job as the legislature is different. Our job as the legislature is to make sure that the entities over which we have oversight are not abusing the public trust.
Fair enough. All right. Representative Huntley was on the list next.
Well, I'll be brief, but I have probably comments later. First of all, the many states...
Make them all now.
Many states have not-for-profit health plans and not-for-profit HMOs. Minnesota has probably a higher percentage in most states, but we also have for-profit health insurance companies operating in this state, and they're regulated by the same scheme. In terms of the state bailing out by readjusting our rates, the health insurance companies, or the state health plans, have about 800,000 people. We're a state that has 5 million people in it. And so if we bail them out on our enrollees, it's not a significant, that big a deal for them. And lastly, for Ms. Bruner, I think she underestimated the cost of a broken arm. My wife broke her arm last summer, and it was $15,000. And I will say, let me just continue, and I'll shut up, but... you know, this is a very unusual time. And I don't know why anybody would tell somebody that they have too much reserves. Look at AIG and what we've had to do for them because they didn't keep their reserves up. The marketplace has gone down 20% this year. It went down 40% last year. Warren Buffett, my hero, the value of Berkshire Hathaway is down 62%. This is not a time to reduce the amount of reserves that people have or surpluses.
Mr.
We are in a very serious economic situation. The healthcare industry is in a state of collapse. We don't know what's going to happen next year, and I don't think we should reduce the reserves that our health plans have.
Mr. Chair.
President Lane.
Comparing this situation to AIG is comparing apples to elephants. AIG is in a totally different realm, and they put out $60 trillion worth of IOUs when they only had $5 trillion to their name. They didn't have risk-based capital. They didn't have even ordinary insurance regulation. They were outside it all. And that is the poster child of why we are in this situation. Because without regulations, they violated every level of what insurance should do. They put out insurance on things that were the credit default swaps, insurance for, I bet that the credit, the mortgage credit market is going to fall. Pay me when I win that bet. They put out these kind of things way in excess of what they had to their name and beyond any insurance regulation whatsoever. So they are the poster child for the condition that we're in. We are talking about something altogether different, which is about our regulation and our oversight of the health plans in Minnesota, whom we feed our public dollars and over whom we have oversight.
President Lasser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who might best be able to answer this. It might be Ms. Bruner, I'm not sure, but I believe that the public prepaid medical assistance, general assistance, Minnesota care programs are the majority of the nonprofit HMO plans now that so much has switched to third-party administrator ERISA plans. And if that's true, I think that puts a different spin on this because they are, per the federal MA required to get actuarial equivalent sound rates. And I think it does have an implication for the state budget. If we are building up reserves related to the public book of programs beyond what the risk is that we're asking them to assume. That, I think, is a different situation than the private market. And if we don't have time to answer that, I would love to get information from the smarter experts here on whether that's a correct understanding.
If you can do it like in 20 seconds, and then you can talk to Representative Loeffler later.
The answer to your question, Representative Loeffler and Mr. Chairman, in 2007, at the end of the year, there were 930,000 enrollees in HMOs and county-based purchasing organizations. Of that number, 415,000 were in public programs, Minnesota Care, medical assistance, and so on. 409,000, a smaller number, were in commercial employer groups, and about 100,000 were in Medicare programs sold by these HMOs. So you're correct in saying that the public program segment of the business is now the largest part of the business.
Okay. Well, we are out of time here. I'm going to move that we lay House File 1012 on the table. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you. Oh, I'm Mark here.